evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, March 26, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. And if you are listening live over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250. And our access code is 449-389. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on the donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is 15 verses, I believe, tonight, maybe 16. It's Matthew 26. We're going to read from 14 through 30. It's the Last Supper. Matthew 26, verses 14 through 30. Okay, if I can find it. All right, 14. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went on to the chief priests and said unto them, What will you give me, and I will deliver him unto you? And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. And from that time he sought opportunity to betray him. Now, the first day of the feast of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying unto him, Where wilt thou that we prepare for thee to eat the Passover? And he said, Go into the city to such a man, and say unto him, The master saith, My time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at thy house with my disciples. And the disciples did as Jesus had appointed them, and they made ready the Passover. And when the evening was come, he sat down with the 12. And as they did eat, he said, Truly I say unto you, that one of you shall betray me. And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and began every one of them saying to him, Lord, is it I? And he answered and said, He that dippeth his hand with me in the dish, the same shall betray me. The Son of Man goeth, goeth, as it is written of him, But woe unto that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It had been good for that man that he had not been born. Then Judas, which would betray him, answered and said, Master, is it I? He said unto him, Thou hast said. And as they were eating, Jesus took the bread and blessed it and brake it and gave it to his disciples and said, Take, eat, this is my body. And he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, Drink ye all of it, for this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. But I say unto you, I will not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. Okay, I'm going to stop there. That was verse 14 through 30. A little bit of hard time seeing this tonight. I've been working all day on the computer, and my eyes are just about shut, so hopefully I don't have to read anything else tonight. All right, we're going to move forward. Last week we spoke about putting together a course which we're diligently working on, and I believe I mentioned last week that I'm writing a book. Actually, I've been writing a book for quite some time. I've got a lot of material, and most of my book is pretty much written already. It's a matter of putting it together and bringing things together to make it harmonize in a sensible way and a fashion. It's going to be a book unlike any other book. I'm really trying to bring together all of the necessary tools and ideas and consent, how we consent to our government. The two processes, one is, of course, through the jury, and the other is through the political process, and try to bring all that together. The book is also going to cover a lot on court access, a lot on law, common law. I mean, we got really a lot of subject matters. It's probably going to be a pretty thick book. I'm thinking at least 400 pages, maybe more than that. I don't even know. But as time goes on, we'll find out. I think the book will be pretty close to done in about 2 weeks. I've been spending day on day on this thing and just trying to pull it all together. And the book, I'm going to use the book as a guide for the course that we put together. Now, the name of the course, it's going to be up at nationallibertyalliance.org, okay? And if you go under free courses, you'll find the Government by Consent course registration. Now, that's up there right now. If you try to go into the course itself, you may get a page and, you know, I'm going to disconnect that. I think I did disconnect that. But I'll disconnect that as soon as I get off the mic tonight. No one should try to take the course yet. It was just a test up there right now on one page. But in any event, the course should be live, I'd say, in about 2 weeks, maybe less. But I know I was planning on trying to start the course on the 5th, which would be next Thursday, I think. The 5th. I gotta look on the calendar. Yeah, I think the 5th is next Thursday. Yeah, that's not going to happen. But I don't have it for next Monday, but sometime between that Monday and the following Monday, I'll have it up there. Anybody that registers, you'll get an email when the course becomes live, or you can go up and check from time to time. Now, this particular course, we've been back and forth and talking about giving it to free to certain people who are really doing things like becoming committeemen or going into becoming an administrator. And then maybe charging X amount of dollars for the course for those people who are not participating in that fashion. But I was talking with other leadership and throwing things back and forth. And I think the best way to deal with it is anybody who takes the course, we're going to ask them to give us a donation, a monthly donation of $5 a month or more. And we're going to ask people to commit to that donation for 2 years. I think in 2 years we'll definitely be in a position where we'll be getting money sources from other places. Until we come into power, we can't get those money sources, but there are money sources that we can get a hold of once we the people take control of the political process and the judicial process, particularly the judicial process, not so much on the political process. And the political process can only come in when we take control of the judicial process to make sure we get courts of justice and not the courts of injustice that we have today. One of the part, which I'm not going to get too much into that plan. Matter of fact, this course is going to teach about all these things because the main focus of this course is government by consent, okay? And that's pretty much what we call this course, government by consent. So people can go up here and register now. They can, and again, it'll be a week or two before we get the course up there. Hopefully I'll get the whole course up, but if I can get a good portion of the course up, I can open it up as I'm continuing to put the course up. And I don't think anybody's going to be able to catch up to me on that. So I might be able to move along quickly enough so that people don't come to an end of a course before I finish. But we'll work something out and we'll try to get it going as soon as possible. So again, the course is going to require a $5 donation on a monthly, or every month, and a commitment to do that for 2 years. Of course, you're on your honor to do that for 2 years. You know, you won't be able to access the course unless you are A, registered, okay, and B, you're donating $5 a month or more. Anybody that is already donating $5 a month or more, obviously, then will have free access as soon as they register. So again, that's the key. We have to do something to get money, and we have to get money on a regular basis to keep the bills being paid and also to start doing some other cases in the court. We seriously have to do a case against the judiciary, and that's going to be key, and I'd like to have that case ongoing and even completed if possible before, you know, things take that that move towards a critical mass. I think it'll be very difficult for them to kind of trip us up on that particular case. But we'll talk about that a little later. I think we have a powerful case, and I don't think they're going to be able to really deny the conclusions of the case. That'll also free us up on the political side of things, because then the next move after that is to get power back to the elected committeemen. Right now, across America, I'm reasonably confident to say that there are no elected committeemen anywhere in the United States of America. Now, I may be wrong on that. There might be a state here or some counties kind of off the grid here or there that that still are in the process of having elected committeemen, and that's good for them. But generally speaking, they're not. Pennsylvania doesn't, I can tell you that. New Jersey doesn't. I absolutely can tell you New York doesn't. And there's various other states I looked into. I believe I looked into Connecticut. Connecticut doesn't. And I know I looked in some states up in New England. I looked in some states out west and some in the central part of the nation. And all the ones I've looked into, I can tell you, no elected committeemen. I have spoken to many committeemen on many of the states, and they swear they're elected. They believe they're elected. And when I try to explain to them, they just don't want to hear it. But they're not elected. And therefore, this nation is being really driven by unelected individuals. We'll explain that whole, in the course, that process will be explained. The process that they have going on now, how they've controlled the political process, will be explained in that course. And the process by which we can take it back, the plan to take it back. Now, we still doing, well, we're not really having meetings on building up the committees of safety anymore because it just isn't time to do that. But there are people that are active in that and are moving forward on that. I was talking with Jan earlier today. And so I don't want to discourage them. I think they should continue. Anybody who is working on a committee of safety or decides to pick one up and do one, fine, do it. You could morph very quickly and much easier. If you're already working in your county, being active, building a committee of safety, getting all the necessary things together to do things, and then once the committeeman process opens up, they can move right over into the committeeman process very easily with a pretty considerable number of people that'll make things easier to work in order to take control of the committeeman process and therefore our political system back to we, the people, on the grassroots level. Well, we actually make the decisions and not someone up on the federal end of things, making these decisions. And so the committeeman process is an important process, but our most important thing that we're doing, okay, is working for the grand juries and the trial juries to make sure that we get juries that are free, unadulterated, for juries that are free to decide what is the law and what are the facts together. So juries that understand nullification, and again, we have to take over the communicating with the people to come in to become jurists. We have to orientate them. We have to guide them through the system. We have to protect them from the prosecutor who will abuse them, and we need to protect them from anybody who would abuse them. I don't think anyone really can abuse them except the prosecutor. And he does it all day long. The old saying, I can indict a ham sandwich is quite true, unfortunately. It is true. They seem to have a license to lie. And what they love to do is they'll indict certain numbers of people, and then they'll find other people, and they may not even go through an indictment for them, as they add people to the case. Or they try to make deals with them, which they don't have the power or the authority. Who elected them? Who gave them that authority? Only the people can do that. And so these are the things we need to learn about. And, of course, we have to understand the law. We have to understand the history. We have to understand the making of America in order to really be able to self-govern ourselves. And so we do indeed can have government by consent if the people want it. And so that's what this course is going to be all about. I really believe it's going to be a powerful course. And also the book. Now, the book, again, the course will be working off of the book, so it'll kind of follow the same thing, and there'll be a lot of stuff in the course that's in the book, but we won't have everything. There'll be a lot of things in the book that will not be in the course, but I'll try to get as much as we can into the course. Now, we were going to start it live. We were going to record the course live one evening a week. I think we were looking, I don't know if I shared this with anyone, but we were looking at Thursday. And at first we thought, well, we'll do it for an hour every Thursday. And I know there's going to be a whole bunch of hours, so we're looking at doing 45-minute lectures and then maybe 15, 20 minutes of open forum Q&A. But if, in order to get this done in any time, and again, we may have a problem with moving too quickly and people, I'm not sure how the course would work if it's kind of still on the open end and people hit the end of it. We're trying to figure that out now. But the course will take a lot more than 1 hour a week. It will take us over a year to do it. And then we thought, well, okay, maybe we'll do 3 hours on a Thursday and do three sessions in a row. And with that, the three sessions in a row, let's say just 25 weeks, okay, that's 75. So 25, 26 weeks, that's half a year there. But going back and forth and then preparing the PowerPoints, getting the book together, putting the course together, and again, those two things work together, then putting the PowerPoints together, then trying to keep up with the course, I've come to realize it's just too much. So what we're going to do is within the next 2 weeks, I feel confident, if not 2 weeks, very close to that, but maybe even before 2 weeks. You know, I'm really making some headway and putting things together. What we'll do is that the course is going to be, you know, done offline. I'm going to post all the information up, and each section will have a Q&A question, a quiz. As you progress, anybody who's taken the other courses, this course is quite different than the other two courses. I don't know whether maybe at the time when we put the courses together, this feature wasn't available, or maybe it was, and when we put it together, we just didn't have the knowledge of that. Actually, the technician to put it together for us was with the people that we paid to actually put our website up. But in any event, we do have in this course the ability where we would write a couple of paragraphs, leave some blanks in there, and put the list of the answers on the right side, and you drag and drop it. One of the problems we're having with people who are writing in the answers, they didn't get the spelling right, or maybe there was an extra space somewhere where it shouldn't have been, or something just, you know, quirky, and people would get stuck on the course. Some people might even have left the course because they got frustrated. We did have solutions for all that. We required, you know, a connection to one of the individuals, Catherine, who was really handling all the problems and taking care of the technical side of things and explaining to people, you know, how to get past certain problems. And we haven't had a complaint about the course for quite some time now, so I got to believe we've really solved all those problems on those other two courses. People are still actively taking those courses. People are starting all the time and maybe in the middle of it, you know, all different places, people moving at their own speed. So, again, we haven't had many complaints that I've not known of for quite some time on those courses. But this third course, like I said, it's going to be under free courses because, in a sense, it is free, but you just have to be a member. Maybe you could say that that's paying for it. I'm not sure how we can figure that out. But the bottom line is only people who are supporting NLA are going to be able to take the course. And again, $5 a month. I mean, my goodness, that's a cup of coffee and a roll and butter or something once a month. You give that up, and there's your $5. Matter of fact, I'm sure that'll cost you more than $5. Get yourself a cream cheese bagel and a coffee, and I know it's more than $5. Now, anybody who is really, and again, anybody who's already given, then you've already been approved to that point. Once we set the, you know, the technical sides up, you know, it'll just be, you just have to fill out the registration. So again, people can start filling out that registration right now, but do not try to click on the course. I'm going to disable that before the evening is out. But anyway, if you want to take that course, get out there now and start registering. Now, again, going back to the commitment, we're asking people to commit $5 a month for 2 years. Now, $5 a month for 1 year is $60, okay? So it's not a lot of money. And over the course of 2 years, it's $120. And I'm sure you'll be finished with the course before the first year is out. You could be finished with the course in a few months, I'm sure, depending on how much time you put into it. But again, it'll be an in-depth course. But nevertheless, we need the support of the people to do the things we're doing, to pay the bills, to keep the lights on, so to speak, and to file more cases. We really need to file more cases. Now, we will continue. We don't have to pay much more money to file cases into the court that, you know, into the case that we have as far as, you know, being a depository, because we're only filing maybe indictments or papers on non-judicial foreclosures, and hopefully we'll get back to habeas corpuses and filing that up there. And that doesn't, you know, require a lot of mailing with the, you know, as far as the indictment would be concerned. You know, we'd file the papers with the court. That puts us under the auspices of the court. We file them with Jeff Sessions, Attorney General, and the President of the United States, and then we also file with Senator Grassley on the Judiciary Committee. So anybody doing the other paperwork, you know, they give us a donation, which helps offset the cost, and so that's helpful, and it's not a burden on us. But we want to file actual cases against individuals, opening up like judges. We need to go after the judiciary as a whole. I'm not sure exactly how we will do that. I have to think that out. But, you know, we can't name every single judge in there. But we'll figure out how we're going to go after them as a whole. And we need to file a case. It'll probably be filed in Albany. And it'll be just for that purpose. And there's other cases. We need to file a case concerning the fact that we have no elected committee men anywhere in the United States. And, you know, there has to be a special case that we've thought about putting together. Matter of fact, we have already filed something like that here in New York, and since then we've really matured quite a bit, judicially speaking. And we have a lot more knowledge of the law and how the process works and a lot of things. And so... You know, but we still have the idea on how we're going to approach that, and we'll share that as time comes, when it's time to share and talk about it. But anyway, it is another kind of a case we do want to file. And there's others. There's just a whole bunch of other cases we can think of that we need to be filing. So anyway, we need the support of the people. Without that support, you know, we really can't do anything. Now, going back to maybe someone who is unable to come up with $5 a month, there are some people who are on a fixed income and they get really not much at all, and they just really can't afford that $5. Well, if that is the case, you know, we put a note down on the bottom of the registration that they can give a call to Jan, and we can kind of flip the switches from our end and give them access without having to pay for a donation or anything, because they can't afford it. So anybody that's in that kind of a situation, we will help them. We don't want to deny anyone of this course. I think it's going to be an extremely important course for anyone that wants to do anything to help save this nation and to achieve the knowledge to do that. And also anybody who wants to get access into the court on how to write papers, you know, causes of actions, and, you know, giving a lot of information on what that is all about and how that works, how to write a wherefore clause, what is the necessary paperwork you need to actually make the filing in the beginning, and some of the important rules that we have to be, you know, concerned with, and some of the rules that that really are a problem. We're going to talk about in rem, the problems, and that's it. Those are in the rules, the federal rules of the court, and how is it bled over into the law of the land, and it does not belong on the land. In rem process is out at sea. It's a way for them to go after pirates, and once if they seize their ship, they really put a hold onto the ship without having to go through the individual. It's called in rem process. When they bring that ship back into port, they have to file a proof of claim on it, and then they take ownership of the ship. You know, that's kind of one of the things, and I'm sure there's other things, but the in rem process does not belong in the law of on the law of the land. The land requires due process of an individual. Instead of going after the property, you have to go and sue the person first, give that person due process before you can take their property. And then you have to win that within the court to be able to take that property still after that. Where at sea, again, it's just a matter of taking the ship and then filing the necessary paperwork at port. Pirates aren't going to come to port and say, hey, by the way, that's my ship. I'd like it back, you know. So anyway, we're going to talk about that in the course and some other problems probably. Go through a lot of forms in the court, in the course, forms you'll need, you know, to as things, how things work, how to write motions, things of that nature. So, and then again, you know, with a lot of the law that we're going to teach and talk about, we're going to talk about U.S. codes. We're going to talk about, you know, common law in itself, the law of the land, which ultimately is the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights, and any of the legislation written that's lawfully written by our legislators. All of that is the law of the land. And so we're going to talk about that in some good detail, and, of course, the Bill of Rights and so on. And with all that, you should be able to write some good papers. We have about 10, at least 10 really good memorandums that we'll post and maybe comment on a little bit about. And those are papers that people can use, memorandums in their own cases. They should be able to take things in and out, put new things in, or just use it the way it is. You just have to write it from your own perspective, from your own court case. But they're good memorandums to really support your case. Or how to, you know, when you open up an Article III court, you want to put a memorandum in on that. And what an Article III court is and how it's expected to proceed and by what authority it proceeds. And that there is no other court that's lawful that Congress can create other than an Article III court. So we have a memorandum on that. So you can write something in the body of the paperwork concerning the fact that it's an Article III court and just give a few words, a sentence or two, and then refer to the memorandum as your support that this is the fact, this is the conclusion. What's a court of record? Again, we have one on that. We have a law on law. We have a memorandum of law on law itself and quite a few other memorandums that are very helpful in order to really support your case. So, again, that'll all be part of the course and be very helpful for people to make access into the courts and write papers and so on. So anyway, hopefully a lot of people will take it and we'll get a lot of support from that and we'll take it from there. Let me see what else we have here I want to talk about before we move on to questions and announcements. Well, maybe that's about it. Okay. So last week, you know, I did speak a lot about the committee men and the committees of safety and so on and so forth. And some people got the impression as if we're going to be putting a lot of time into that and that we're bringing that above what we're doing with the grand jury. And I'm sorry to anybody who got that impression. It is not the case. Absolutely would never be the case. The key to winning back America is first and foremost winning back the courts. If we can't get courts of justice, we can't get a political process that runs justly. It's not possible. Because everything is controlled by the courts as far as empowering we the people to take back lawfully what is ours in order that we can consent to government. And so we have to have the courts. The committee man process, giving any kind of power and authority to those people, is not even possible. Not even possible without a court case. And we can't file that court case until we win the courts. But again, we do have a plan for that, and we do want to spend some time about talking about the committee man process. And again, the committees of safety, although we're not going to be pushing them very hard anymore, people who are running through with those committees of safety, again, continue on because you're preparing really for something bigger later on. Because the plan had always been to get committees of safety going in as many counties as we can, and therefore we would have groups of people in the counties ready to move into that committee man process when we give them the word. But of course, again, a court case is necessary to get that going. All right, I guess that's all I have for the evening. Jen, do we have any announcements, I guess, first?
Well, there is one. The 9/11 committee is moving along, and one of the things we're finding is that as we get deeper into it, we learn something about a person or thing that happened, which brings up the need for more research, which wasn't included in the original, which can lead to another person or another event, another thing. And so we're finding that we are probably generating as much work as we're getting done as we go through it. So we could use a few more volunteers to help us research this problem. So if you have some time to spare, we have plenty of topics. Just email me, jan@nationallibertyalliance.org, and I would appreciate it. That's about the only announcement that I have tonight.
Okay, so again, let me just broaden that a little bit. The 9/11 committee is really an investigative committee on whatever the grand jury is doing right now. The grand jury right now is investigating the 9/11 issue, and we do have things up on our website concerning that potential indictment. If you look under the grand jury, we did make some changes. We broke things up a little bit. We've got the grand jury docket, which just focuses in on the court. And then we created a different page for the indictments that we've got going. So we have a page just for the indictments, whatever indictments we have going. Then we have another page, which we separated because we had all this on one page. We then separated some more information for the grand jury investigations. We have a couple investigations going. One is active right now, but both of them have information up there. We're researching now to find the targets of this investigation. So anybody who would like to help out with that and join this group of people who are investigating. Once we finish with 9/11, we're going to move on to something else. And again, if anybody has any ideas on any kind of an issue that we should move on, and it needs to be something that's a national problem. It needs to be something that really is going to be assist us in a big way to make the point of subversion against we the people, against the United States of America. Because that's what the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury is focused in those cases, to make that case, to take back this nation. And we have to do it through the courts first, and we have a lot of reasons to believe things are going to go well for us and that we're going to be able to get these things through. And so, again, we broke things up in a way that can be a little more digested. Now, if you go up onto the Grand Jury Investigations page, you'll find what we have so far to be viewed concerning 9/11. And anybody who's going to be sitting on that grand jury, and everybody that's hearing my voice is invited, when the time comes, we'll put a call out. You'll have to be a member to get the message because we'll hit our membership up and let them know that we're going to be having a grand jury hearing about 9/11 on such a date, whenever that's going to be. And then we'll come together and decide, like we did last time, on individuals as we go through whether we need to indict these people or not, and then put it out to the vote of the grand jury. And we do that, of course, over the internet here, through our room, right here that we're in right now tonight. People will come on the evening that we call to consider an indictment. So people should be looking at the stuff that we have up there for investigation so that they can come in and make a vote of good conscience. And so what Jan is talking about now is that, things are leading to other things and we're finding more evidence. So we'll be putting more evidence up there. But we do need more people to assist. I think we have 5 people. I think that's what we got, right, Jan? And
right.
We could probably use 25 people. But again, anybody that can assist us with some time doing some research, work things out with Jan. He'll tie in with the committee. And I got to believe that people are given a piece of information or something to seek out and kind of put things together and maybe come back at the end of the week with what your findings are and then pick up your next task. Or maybe you'll have 2 or 3 tasks, maybe they're smaller tasks, and you can accomplish 2 or 3 tasks in a week. I don't know. That has to be worked out with the committee. But we do need help, so please get out there and help. Okay. Also, one note, I know the welcoming committee hopefully will be making an announcement soon concerning what they're doing, but we do have a group, the welcoming committee, and if anybody would like to join that, it's involved with welcoming people to the National Liberty Alliance, helping them get around the website and inviting them to the Monday night program, trying to get them active, talking about the courses, all the education. We have a higher education that we also offer. And just so many things to do. And, we want to get, all hands on deck, so to speak, to really get involved to do the things we have to do to take back this republic. Actually, they call it a democracy, and it just makes me sick to my stomach. And some people with great knowledge, I'm so surprised. I heard one of the Supreme Court justices calling us a democracy. What the heck is that? I mean, come on. If a United States Supreme Court justice doesn't know that we're not a democracy, boy, that is pretty darn bad. And that is the case. And I hear a lot of people talking from time to time. You know, I hear people claim to be, constitutional lawyers. One person in particular, he's on the radio, and he thinks we're a democracy. Come on, you're not a constitutional lawyer if you think, where are you learning this stuff? I mean, this is really, that's how bad and how defunct we the people are in the United States of America. You know, the narrative is not the law amongst the people, amongst really the political process and the judicial process. It's everything else but. But in any event, we need help, so anybody who can help do what we have to do. You know, the welcoming committee can use some help. All right, any questions for the evening?
Yes, I have one good question tonight, and that's three parts. It is, how many people should there be in a grand jury, the number of alternates, and how many people does it take to make a quorum to indict?
Well, 25 people in a grand jury, and that number comes from the Magna Carta. To indict, you need half of that. So I think I heard, Brent, maybe Brent can talk a little bit about this when he comes on, because I think I heard him speak that at least there'd be at least 13, half of the 25. So if you dwindle down to 20, I think you still have to have that 13. So I'm not too sure on that, and I need to do a little more research on that part. We have been, really, the indictments that we've done, we've had more than enough people in the room. There's been times when we've had 200 people in a room and time when we had 50 people in a room going through indictments. And it's been almost always unanimous. And, you know, sometimes we've had a few times where one or two people declined, but the rest of the group went through. So we've never had a problem with the number. It's been very close to unanimous or unanimous. But the detail on that answer, you know, the answer to that question, I think it's 13, but I'll see. I got to dig that up. What was the other part of that question? Something with the trial jury, too?
Number of alternates.
Well, I know they work. I've heard that they work with two. I don't know that they work with any more than that. So you got 12 jurors and two spare wheels. So there's 14 people should someone get ill or sick. Brent might, I know Brent would have a lot more knowledge on that than me, so if he wants to pipe in to correct me, that'd be fine. But I'm pretty sure it's 14, so two alternates. Anything else?
Yeah. Simple majority for the Pettit jury, too, then?
Pettit jury, no. Does not have to be majority. You can have them debating back and forth and finally come to the conclusion we can't settle the matter. Well, they need to stay in that room till they do settle the matter, or they come back out and say, hey, we're going to let them go. You know, if one of the jurists, just one of the jurists holds out and it goes on and on and on, and they finally settle the fact that they're not going to be able to conclude, then they got to set them free. And it's called an acquittal. The judges, these judges that call hung juries, there is no authority. There's nothing in history that gives them any power or any authority to call for a hung jury. No such thing in common law as a hung jury. These people have a duty. They go into the room, and they got to be there for a month. They'll be there for a month. Look, you got to come to a conclusion. That's your duty. And you got to get to the point and say, we're not going to be able to come to a conclusion, and then that'll be that. And then come out and give the decision. The way things are going and the way that these judges are controlling, I have heard of cases where the grand jury indicted and the judge would throw that out. I mean, come on. Are we the people that dumb that we don't even realize how terrible that is? What kind of power and authority did we give these people? Clearly we didn't give them that kind of power or authority. And again, we are that dumb. We've gone to schools that have really down-educated us instead of really educating us. Some of us had a better education than others, maybe, depending on how far back you go. But, you know, today, forget about it. I mean, it's really seriously defunct. And if we, the people, don't start to take control over this now, and look at when we start moving the political process, the people have the power to just say no, okay? They can nullify anything, and they can nullify the required curriculum that the federal government may require and the state may back up or something of that nature. But the people can get together and push their school and, where their children are being learned and say, hey, we're going with this curriculum. We don't care whether it's government approved or not. We want to focus in on these things. People need to get up and take control of their life, and the education of your children is an important part of that. And they're playing politics with our children, I'll tell you right now. You know, we'd like to do a case on that. That's something right there, to take the education back away from central education out of Washington, D.C., because they're being taught progressivism. They're being taught isms. You know, Nazism, you know, communism, socialism, progressivism. So this is what they're being taught. And, you know, people are going to be very surprised one day when they finally sit down and talk to their children, especially when they're adults, and find out that they don't even belong to America no more. It's that bad. It's really that bad. All right, anything else?
Nope, that was it.
Okay, is Brent here tonight?
Yes.
Brent, you got your mic open?
I'm unmuted, I think.
You're
yes.
Unmuted now. Okay,
yes,
we're going to go over to Brent Winters, and Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. Oh, before you go, Gerard, are you here?
He was.
Yeah, Gerard, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm muted.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's
but
unmuted.
I want to hear his voice. Can you hear me? Maybe he's away from his computer. Gerard? Gerard? No, I guess he's not here. Okay, Brent, you got the mic. Take it away.
Thanks. This is Brent. Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And I'm coming to you from the hinterlands of the Wabash River Valley. Everything I say is my opinion. And it may or may not be the opinion of National Liberty Alliance. But they allow me to come on and say what my conclusions are. I do say that most of what I say are study conclusions. I have been known to shoot from the hip. Sometimes I do it and I don't hit the mark. But I like to think that I try hard. Somebody in America needs to do something to teach people about the grand jury. It is, as one fellow said of trust law, the grand jury is as mysterious to people as the doctrine of the Trinity. Nobody can explain it. Allow me to shoot simply about the grand jury concerning the question that was asked. And I use, there are 50 jurisdictions, of course, in America, 50 states, and I use New York as an example for a couple of reasons. As a representative sampling of those 50 jurisdictions, 46 states of the United States use the grand jury. The grand jury. What does the grand jury do? It catches a fellow by the foot, catches him by the toe, and holds on to him and turns him over to the prosecutor to try him for a crime. The grand jury has the power to say yes to the government or to say no. That's the simple fact of the matter. Yes, you may try this person for some criminal act, put his life, liberty, and his property or some combination thereof in jeopardy, or you may not. Yes, you may, government. No, government, you may not. That's what the grand jury does. Now, using New York as an example of the 46 states that still have grand juries, it's impossible to go to criminal trial in these states. Well, as a general rule, that's not always true. They use a grand jury, and it ought to be impossible that you go to criminal trial in these states, especially for felony cases, without the indictment of the grand jury. The grand jury in New York, as an example, for a couple of reasons, because New York, back when our country was moving into the industrial age, rapid pace, back in the after the turn of the last century, the courts of New York, the New York Court of Appeals, which most states would call the Supreme Court of the state, the highest court of the state, the New York Court of Appeals, was an impaneling, for whatever reason, of the most influential judges, arguably the most influential judges of modern times. The things that they said in those courts and the things that they did have stuck with us. Their phrases have been memorable. Men like Learned Hand, for example. Somehow these fellows knew how to turn a phrase when they'd write an opinion, and it had an influence on other juries, courts, judges, prosecutors. The power of words was their craft and trade, and they developed it well. Well, in New York, today, as I speak, grand juries are assembled with 23 members. 23. No alternates are needed for this reason. If only 16 of the 23, 16 or more, is present, then the grand jury can convene. So in New York State, as an example, 23 grand jurors are required. 16 are required to be impaneled in any given instance. 16 are required for a quorum. That means it takes 16 to convene the grand jury and try to indict people, or look into indicting people for crimes, look into catching them by the foot so they can be turned over to the prosecutor and turned over to the trial jury, the petit jury. Well, once the grand jury, well, how do they do that? How many does it take of those 23 or 20 or 21 or 19 or 18 or 17 or 16? Remember, the quorum is 16. It could be the convening of the grand jury in New York could be anywhere from 16 to 23. Well, how many of however many people are there does it take to indict? Answer, same as the trial jury, 12. If 16 members are there, it takes 12 to indict. 17 members, 12 to indict. And so on up to 23. If 23 show up, takes 12 to indict. Now, when a fellow goes to jury, if he gets indicted and goes to a criminal trial in the state of New York, the 12-man jury is impaneled, convened, sworn. Juror means a sworn one who is sworn. A juror must be sworn. Why? Because he's going to witness evidence. That's why. Big responsibility you may decide of a man's. When you go to taking a man's life, liberty, or property, if your yea or nay is to take his life, liberty, or property, that's power. What else we got in this life? We got life, we got liberty, we got property. And all three of those stand and fall together. One goes down, they all go down. Did you know if you go to prison, you're not allowed to control property? It's against the law. You see, if you lose your liberty, go to prison, you lose your liberty. What else do you lose? You lose your rights over property. And really, life stands still for you. It's hard for people to imagine what it's like to be locked up in a cage for a long period of time, locked up to a confined boundary. It's about as ugly as anything that can happen in this life. You say, oh, there are worse things. I know there are bad things. I've known men that have had mortal injuries, crippling injuries. Those are bad. But I said, it's hard to imagine anything that's any worse. It destroys the personality. It discourages the soul. It destroys the wife, the children. It discourages them. It confuses them. It's ugly. Well, you take a man's liberty. You're taking his life and his property. You take his property. His property? Yeah, you take his house. He doesn't have shelter. You take his rights and property. You take his freedoms. He has property and rights and rights in his property. His liberties are his property. Why? They are his rights. They're his responsibilities. You could talk all day the way I'm talking around in circles about life, liberty, and property. One goes down, they all go down. So a juror's power to say yea or nay to the government, to the powers that be, is real power, the ultimate power. But as we must continue to say, the jury, which is the thing around, I use that word precisely, thing, it's an old word that means the governing body, still used in some of the Anglo-Germanic-speaking countries, such as Iceland, the Shetland Islands, places like that, they still have a thang, T-H-A-N-G. Sometimes they call it in some places the thung. The vowels change, but the consonants stay the same. Well, the jury is the thing, T-H-I-N-G in our dialect. It is the thing that decides whether men live or die, or they lose their life, liberty, or property, which is real power, in individual instances. And it's not a majority institution. It is the thing around which all of our common law revolves. It is the thing, the jury is the thing, the grand jury and the petit jury that holds all of our common law, all of our way of life in balanced orbit. As Bagay, I don't know how to pronounce that word. Some people call him Baguette. Some people call him Bagot. He was an Englishman who had a French name, because there are a lot of Englishmen that have French names, because a lot of the Normans that invaded France way back 1,015, not quite a thousand, not quite a thousand years ago now, about 40 years short of 1,000 years. They were people from Norway who had settled on the coast of France, and they picked up the French language and French names. Bagot, maybe that's his name. Baguette. I just know what it looks like when I read it. But he said that there has never been, he was a legal historian, a common lawyer, he said there has never been a country that has ever lost its liberties if they kept their jury. That sounds like a powerful statement, but it really isn't, for this reason. At that time, there was really only one country, two countries, three countries, out of over 150 countries in the world at that time. There's only been a handful of countries that have ever had the jury. And those are the countries that comprise the English-speaking world. There's just a handful of us, half dozen. And then little protectorates and colony-type countries that are descended from England's exploits throughout the world. But this, it is true that as long as English-speaking people have kept their jury, they haven't lost their freedoms. And it is true that if we do lose our juries, we will lose our freedoms. And remember, when you lose your freedom, your liberty, what else do you lose? You lose your life and your property. Don't forget it. Say, are you sure, Brent? Yes. I'm not shooting from the hip on that one. I've been searching that out and contemplating it and chewing it like cud and reading about it, history and reality and in the Bible, for a long, long time. And I won't back up on that one. We got to keep the jury. But the ignorance of the jury is woeful. It is deplorable. And it is our ignorance of truth, not just our ignorance of anything, our ignorance of things that are true that will destroy us. And one of the things that is not known among lawyers, even among judges sitting on the bench, is how many grand jurors it takes to indict, and whether some grand juries, the largest inquisitive juries in the world that I've discovered, are convene in the coal mining, one of the coal mining districts of England. They have their own miners' courts over there in the tin mining areas. These are ancient courts, the tin binders courts, the coal courts, the forest courts, and some of the forests where the forest rights are there. There's one over there that has 45 members, the largest grand jury I've discovered. It convenes 45 members, but how many members does it take of a 45-member grand jury to indict? Answer, 12. It always takes 12. Why? Because our common law tradition at its foundation, at its center, at its point of balance, the jury, is not the majority-driven tradition. The law of the city is all about numbers. Numbers. Everything is numbers. Everything is who has the mostest and the biggest and the bestest. Who has the mostest power to make you do what they want. Who can convene the majority? And the whole system of evil empire is about majority. It's all about notching your gun. It's all about body count. So much so, the evil of it, when we went to Vietnam, officers were promoted on body count. In wars previous we'd had, we followed the common law tradition. Wars where officers were got promotions because they took dirt. They gained territory. Our common law focuses on land, even in our military life. It should. And when we start body counting, we turn into nothing but bloodthirsty, political, foolish people. At every point, with everything we do, get more money, you can get more votes. You say, well, we've got to have majorities in the voting process. Yes, but that is not the foundation of our common law tradition. That is the digging in point. That's where we start. Justice is not done in our state legislatures. It's not done in our national Congress. No, it's just a broad brush of legislation and men attempting to control the future. It has its limited necessary use, and unfortunately, it's become the focus. The focus should be in the courthouse, and even more than that, in your own house. Well, that's what the grand jury is all about. It's not. It's about 12. How many does it take to convict if the grand jury turns the indicted person, the person that they caught by the toe, turns him over to the jury for a trial? How many jurors does it take of a 12-man jury to convict him of a crime, give government, to say yes to the government, that they may take away his life, liberty, or property, or combination thereof? How many does it take? All of them, all 12. The number is the same. It's 12. 12 at the trial level, at the petit jury. Petit, that's the word petit. That's the French word. There's that French influence coming into our common law from the Norman invaders. All these French words we have in our law. It's called law French. It's a bastardization of the French language. If you don't believe it, ask a Frenchman. Of course, I wouldn't know the difference. I just know some of the words, like petition. Petition is from the Norman French. That's one that we use a lot. Distraint and restrainer. And then also, what was that word I was thinking? Oh, there's a whole list of them. I have a whole section in the book, Excellence of the Common Law, a whole section on the bastardized Norman French, and a whole list of the words that I'd thought of over the years that we use habitually now in the American, in our American tongue of English. Well, that's the jury. If you get called to grand jury duty, remember you're in charge, not the prosecutor. Grand jurors feel foolish and stupid when they go to grand jury. They don't know what they're doing. Nobody tells them. The only people who give them instruction is the government. The government, and the grand jury is not a government institution. The grand jury is us. Yeah, there's a difference. We're not, see, people say, oh, we are the government. Well, we ought to be, but we aren't. There's a difference between us and them. And they want us to believe that we're supposed to cooperate with them. Who, the government? But once that happens, of course, complete domination comes because they have a monopoly, the government, the powers that be, have a monopoly on force and violence. That's why it's important that the non-government sector, the private sector, remain independent of government. If it doesn't, well, that's what happened in the communist states. There was no private sector except to say they said there was, but really what it was you join us and you'll have an apartment to live in. You don't join us, you'll live in the street. That's what it came down to. Well, don't lose sight, I don't want to lose sight of this discussion on the grand jury. Grand. Grand is a French word. It means grande, grande, however they say it in French, but it means big, and petit jury means the small jury, the 12-man jury. Grand jury can be anything bigger than 12. As I said, in New York, it takes 16 to convene, but there are 23 members and 12 it takes to indict in every case. Isn't that beautiful? It's beautiful because, again, it's a mystery. Because I've never seen anybody, and I've looked. If you find an answer to this, please tell me. I want to know. I've done a search in history. Why we in America impaneled 12 men, not 10, 12, for the petit jury, the trial jury. And I've come up with an empty sack. But I have discovered that men have written a lot about it. And it is true that as we trace back from back across the pond to England, they've used a grand jury. I know I've read cases of grand juries from the 1300s. The 1300s. They wouldn't hang anybody in England until they were tried. And they weren't tried until the grand jury indicted them. They were very proud of that. It was part of being an Englishman, and an important part. But we trace it back to England, and then the tribes that came to that island, we trace them back to the Jutland Peninsula, which is today called Denmark. It used to be called Jutland, and the people that lived there were called Jutes, and those are the Vikings. Now, the Anglo-Saxons that came to England were just as nasty, sordid, and even in many ways more vicious, as were the Norwegians, but they even had the same kind of ships that are so famous and wearing those helmets with horns on tops and all that baloney. But they were all nasty, nasty people, and murderous and viciously murderous and bloodthirsty. But the Danes were properly the Vikings, and they were the ones that lived on Jutland. But the few related tribes, they were all related by blood, were the Anglos, or the Angels, as some people call them, and the Saxons. They all lived there together, but the Anglos and the Saxons were living, they lived more down at the base of that peninsula and up into it a little, and the Jutes were on up as it extended out into the sea up there, that northern sea. Well, we can trace it back to there. We can find records, but then after that, we try to go back and it gets lost. The jury, where'd it come from? It gets lost. The 12-man jury gets lost in the fog of antiquity. But if we keep going back, we see that it is part of the gospel records of the book called the Bible, the first four gospels of the newer testimony of God, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, make it very clear that Jesus Christ impaneled a jury. What does that mean? That means just like we do today, he grabbed 12 men that were standing around and asked them to be witnesses, to give their verdict on the most important events that have ever occurred among the race of man. And they did it. And we even go back before that, and we see the number 12 prominent in the record. The best and most, by far and away, attested ancient record we have, the Bible, going way back, 1,500 years, 3,000 years recorded history. And the number 12 comes up, and every time it comes up in that record, and even outside of it, every time it comes up, if you look close, you'll discover it has to do with government and men in government and how government works. So 12 is the number. But let me get to, that's a little on the grand jury, when I found out about it, let me get to the thing here we call the Declaration of 76, slide some things out of the way, if I can. Well, I'm not going to be able to, but I wanted to talk a little bit. My computer starts gyrating. I can't move things until it gets done. But on the Declaration of 76, we got down to that paragraph that talks about removing men out of this country to England to try them for pretended crime. Now, last time we talked about what it meant to, why it was important that men be tried in a district where they, as prisoners say, where they caught their crime, or where they caught their case. That's the way men in the prison say it. They caught their case. You catch your case. I've known men that have caught their case. They were from West Virginia, and they caught their case in California and were tried there. How do I know? Well, I was the lawyer that defended them. It was an odd situation. And it didn't really work that well, and I could tell we were in downtown Los Angeles. It was a grueling case, one of those that sticks out in your mind. And the jury was made up of television producers and folk like that, city folk, I should say. And my client was a man that used to spend his time when he was a boy rat fishing, he said. He told me the story of how they used to rat fish in West Virginia and in the coal mining regions, how they'd go down to the dump where everybody dumped their trash out in the mountains, and they'd get a rod and reel and put cheese on the end of it, cast it out into the trash heap, and wait for a rat to swallow it. And they'd hook him, just like going fishing. Amazing story, all the things he could tell me they used to do to occupy themselves. Well, the jury was drawn in that case, and that jury did not understand this man from West Virginia, this coal miner, and he was a coal miner. Disabled, had recently disabled, and happened to be in California when he was arrested falsely. And the jury didn't understand him a bit. And we could tell that that was the case. And I remember the judge even made great note of it. But it didn't help. He wasn't the one making the decision. But what I want to focus on when it comes to the being tried, the word I want to focus on is pretended. Pretended crimes, it says in this particular paragraph of our Declaration of 76. What are pretended crimes? Well, that was a problem. That was one of the big problems. The big problems that they were facing. Well, is it a problem we're facing today? This is the reason, one of the great reasons, in this complaint called the Declaration of 76, that they decided to separate from Britain. Pretended crimes are crimes that aren't crimes at all, that the government, the courts, the prosecutor says are crimes. Grand jurors and petit jurors are often dim-witted enough to go along with it. Pretended crimes. What are pretended crimes? Pretended crimes are crimes that the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God do not give criminal jurisdiction of men over. I'm going to say that again. Pretended crimes are supposed crimes that the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God never give governments among men jurisdiction of. For example, the crime, this is part of our own history as Americans, the crime, pretended crimes, of manufacture, distilling, and sale and transportation of alcoholic beverages. That's not a crime. That's not a crime. How do I know? Because the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God do not anywhere intimate that that's a crime. Now, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God teach us clear as crystal that stuff is dangerous. It can ruin your life, ruin your family, it can kill you, it can give you terrible diseases, it can distract you, it can mar your senses to where you're a danger to others, especially if you're driving a car. I've even read cases where men became dangerous as drunks, driving buggies through the streets and killing people, running over people. Abe Lincoln's near cousin, a fellow by the name of Denny Hanks. Denny Hanks grew up with Abe Lincoln. He grew to be almost 100. He was crossing the street on the courtyard square in Charleston, Illinois, and a man driving a team of horses like Yehu ran over him and killed him. I suppose he was old enough. He didn't hear. He wasn't alert enough. That's what the bottle and the cork will do for you if you're not careful. But that doesn't mean it's a crime. In the same way with Mary G. Warner. No place in the laws of nature, the laws of nature of God that grant criminal jurisdiction to governments of men over the smoking of weed. Pretended crimes, as our Declaration of 76 says. Nothing but pretended. And for sure, you say, well, I think that you say, Brent, I disagree with you. Okay, let's say you disagree. Still, there is no pinch or slice or sliver of evidence that gives the general government in Washington, D.C., any jurisdiction over marijuana, drugs, medicine, the practice of medicine, the practice of law in the states. Wow, I could go on and on. The general government in Washington, D.C. doesn't have any of that. But yet, the FBI and the CIA dominate the scene. The NSA dominate the scene over such things and trade information and collude with the RCMP of Canada, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and they have no jurisdiction at all. Well, I got to move through this information a little bit more. King George, he was the George. He was the third, the George the Third of England. He was king during our war for separation from Britain. King George prosecutors, his attorneys general, were accusing Americans of crimes. And instead of respecting the right to be tried before a common law jury of their peers, remember peers is from the word, the Latin word, our English word, pair. It means one corresponding to you, like a pair of shoes, a match, that which knows you. It's your peers. By the word, that phrase, that word, peers, is lifted out of Magna Carta. It was, that's a common law document of government, as is our Constitution of the United States. And the word pares, that's the way that it was written in Latin, so the Pope could read it. Magna Carta was. And the Latin word pares is used, and we say peers. It's the same word, just the vowels are taken into a different dialect. Neighbors. Well, they were dragging men out of the states, or out of the colonies here, we call them states now, to England to try them so they wouldn't get a fair trial. They couldn't get convictions impaneling their neighbors. Each in his own colony and county. That's where your neighbors are. And they were in that time. So King George removed them to civil laws, admiralty tribunals in England, admiralty law tribunals. Admiralty is a martial kind of a law, as is martial law, admiralty law, martial law, the law of the city, the code of Rome, the canon law of the church. All of those are from the same source, the Code of Justinian, and they are a martial kind of a law, arising originally, by the way, in modern times, from the Code of the Roman Legions, the Code of the Roman Legions. Now, to take this on back, people like that kind of stuff. They think there's something that can be said for the surety of military law. Make them do it. Well, I was a military man once. By God, if you didn't do what they told you, they had ways of making you do it. How? Force, that's how. Discomfort. They put you on bread and water for 3 days, that for a start, first offense. And then, with Sunday in the middle, try to go easy on you. Then, next time, bread and water during the week, 3 days. Next time, the brig. And it went on after that. That hard labor, hard labor. All sorts of punishments could be done. They get conformity. That's martial law. And Rome started as a city. It started by about 300 families there around Palatine Hills. They formed together for the common defense. And it was from the start, it was all about the armed bands. And the armed bands were the powerful men. They had weapons. They controlled that society. That society grew and grew and grew until they controlled all of the known world down there. And same law, same fundamental law. It was Babylonian to the hilt. It really came from Babylon, but in modern times it came together in a way that was recorded and came down to us as the Code of Justinian. And it rules almost every country on the faces of our earth today. Almost every country on the faces of our planet are under some form of the Code of Justinian. That's right. except the common law countries, of which there are only about five major ones. And we don't do that. We don't say, look, we want to be like Italy was before World War II. We want to have a powerful man in office that will make the trains run on time. We're sick of all this lollygagging around and people not pulling their weight. Well, I want people to pull their weight too, of course, but I don't want government to make them do it, because once you have that, you have tyranny. Unlike our common law tradition, in the civil law tradition, crimes are against the state. Against the state, against the government. And in a lot of countries, they're fashioned in their indictments that they're against the ruler, whoever he is, by name, personally. Crimes are personal offenses against the men in charge. And it's usually personified in a chief officer. Personal offenses against the boss in Russia, the emperor in China. And all this makes punishments a matter of personal vengeance from the government. No, I'm not exaggerating. That's the way it works. If take it to its logical conclusion. That's why when Hitler had men hung for crimes, they were hung for crimes against him. He was the chancellor. There's a law of the city word, chancellor. It has to do with the chancel, the confessional booth. He was the chancellor. He was the information getter. And he, when he hung men who offended him personally, it wasn't uncommon that he would hang them by piano wire. And he would hang them 9 times before he allowed them to finally hang and die. That was his orders. Why? Well, that's the law of the city tradition. It's a crime against him personally, the man in charge. Same thing was true, of course, in the Roman Empire. Same thing is true in Russia. Same thing is true. It was a personal crime against the emperor of Rome. Yep. And boy, the vengeance then comes out. And that's why we have a provision in our Constitution, by the way, to help guard against such madness. And the provision is called, we have a right against unusual and cruel and unusual punishment. Why? Because that's part of the doctrine, acceptable doctrine of the law of the city, that you torture people when you kill them. We're going to have them hung, drawn and quartered, or drawn and quartered and hung, or gutted and then hung while he's still alive, or flayed alive. All these things are crucified. How's that one? All these things are part of the law of the city. Crucifixion is death by asphyxiation. You finally get so tired you can't push yourself up or pull yourself up with your arm, and you just choke to death because you can't draw air in. You've been hanging like that for so long without water or food. It's miserable. That's cruel and unusual punishment. God doesn't approve, by the way. And in our common law tradition, we have laws against that. They do not have laws against that in other countries. And if they do, because their tribunals are in writing mostly in secret, in South America, they do it anyway. And they're doing it all over the world as we speak. Do we realize what we have in our common law? Well, the more false crimes that rulers manufacture, the more rulers dominate and control people using terror of prosecutorial threat and vengeance. Who are the terrorists of our world today? In our own country, who are the terrorists? The IRS are terrorists, no question. They do all they can to cow men and women, to make them afraid, throw people in jail, make examples of people. People are afraid of the IRS. That's terror. And the law of the city, the word terror is expanded a little, and terror, a territory, was the area around the city. There had to be a city around the city over which the city, the powerful men of the city, extended their terror, territory. We have vestiges of it in our own language. Delegates to the First Congress of the United States meeting to address British Parliament's reaction to the Boston Tea Party, and I'll close with this, they all agreed. I'm going to quote the Congress of the United States. This is what our First Congress said in reaction to the Boston Tea Party. It said this: the respective colonies are entitled to the common law of England, and more especially to the great and inestimable privilege of being tried by their peers of the vicinage according to the course of that common law. That's so good, I'm going to read it again. Got some big words in it. I'm trying to keep them from tangling up as they tumble over my teeth and tongue. I'll try it again. This is the Congress of the United States responding to the Boston Tea Party. The respective colonies are entitled to the common law of England, and more especially to the great and inestimable privilege of being tried by their peers of the vicinage, their neighbors, according to the course of that common law. Now, for this reason, as far back to the 14th century, by the way, John Wycliffe, the man who first translated the Bible, the complete Bible, into English, the 14th century, John Wycliffe had persuaded the English Parliament to bar any Englishman from being tried outside England without leave of Parliament. See, this idea that came up in a Declaration of 76, this complaint about dragging people off to other places so they wouldn't be tried by a jury of their neighbors, was occurring in England after Magna Carta in the 1300s, the middle of the 1300s, about 1370. John Wycliffe had tremendous influence with Parliament. And they asked him often to come and advise them to what he thought about things. He was called the smartest man in the blasted country. And probably so. He's still called the flower of Oxford scholarship. That's his title in England. But he's persuaded Parliament to bar Englishmen from being tried outside England without leave of Parliament. Never forget a jury of one's peers or one's neighbors, those living about one's home. You see, what was going on was this. Rome was taking men out from England, dragging them out, kidnapping them if they had to, and dragging them to Rome to be tried for their lives. And Wycliffe said, that's enough. Now, those folks don't have any jurisdiction here. And when the federal government comes into the states and drags men off to be tried, well, they're doing it all over the world. They've been doing it for this torture thing's coming up now, has been for the last 15 years. There's no question. There's nothing to debate. Torture is not a part of the American tradition. The Japs did it during World War II. The Germans did it during World War II. We were appalled by it. Why would we want to engage in such nefarious, evil activity? But yet, there are other wise, right-thinking Americans think that's okay. Why? Because we've lost our common law sensibilities. That's why. And our common law sensibilities arise, says Justice Joseph Story of the United States Supreme Court, from its Christian foundation. And without that, there are no sensibilities. Period. Every man becomes his own god, or he allows demons to be gods, or his own self, which is just as bad or worse, making stuff up as he goes. No, there's a lawgiver. There's a true one. The only true lawgiver. He set the standard. And if there's no appeal outside of men to him, then we live under tyranny. Well, that's what I know about the jury. John or Gerard, whoever's there, back to you. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Gerard, are you here? All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up the Q&A. I'm going to first ask that people, if we have anyone new here that wants to ask a question, we should allow those people a moment or two to get into the queue first. Or if we have people from past meetings that never got up to the queue and would want to get into the queue today, let's give them a moment or two to get in, and then everyone else can get into the queue. Okay, let's see. All right, I disabled, just let everybody know, I did disable access to the course, which really the course just had one test, question, quiz area there. And but I'm looking at the calendar and I'm looking at the work to be done. I'm going to shoot for next Monday. I don't know that I can meet that, but maybe by next Monday the course will be open. If not, I think it's pretty solid to say probably the following Monday. But again, as soon as that course is up there and running, we will send out an email, and of course we will be announcing it on Monday nights that the course is up and running. But you will get an email that the course is up and running. And again, anybody who wants to register for that course, go up to nationallibertyalliance.org. highlight free courses, come down and click on Government by Consent Course Registration. That's Gov by Consent Course Registration. And fill that out in order to prepare for the course. A donation, as I mentioned, of $5 a month or more, with a commitment of 2 years, that's $60 a year, total of $120 over the course of 2 years. If you want to give more, $10 a month or more. But again, this is all about supporting National Liberty Alliance. We don't want to charge for the course, but we do have to make money somehow to pay the bills. So again, I don't think $5 a month is much. I think the work we're doing here and what we have on our website is worth a heck of a lot more than $5 a month, and it's free to anyone. There are people who aren't even members that come out here, and they can peruse our site and see almost everything up there. I think the only tab that is not available to someone who doesn't sign up as a member is the members tab itself. But pretty much everything else is up here. Of course, they can't take any of the free courses without signing up as a member in order to get into the course. So we have those other two courses, the civics course and the constitutional course. Those courses are totally free. And I'd like to call Government by Consent course really free to our people, anybody who supports us. So again, $5 a month or more. Right now, I'm pretty sure we can say that in order to donate, in order to get to that course, you'd have to click on the buttons that really go through the processor that we have. We have a software and an institution that processes the money from the credit card or to the bank and so on. We also have PayPal up there, but PayPal, we're not sure whether we're going to be able to connect that. So if anybody is giving on PayPal, we'll figure out what we're going to do with that and make sure that they have access into the course. So we'll see how we work that out, but I'm sure something will be done. And again, anybody that, once the course gets started, there's a problem and someone is already donating and they can't get to the course, you give a course to Jan and a call to Jan and we'll try to figure out what the problem is and make sure we can get you access. All right, let me see if anybody's into the queue yet. Okay, yeah, we got a couple people into the queue. So let's go for our first caller. Gerard, are you here yet? It is a Florida call. I'm not sure what the name is, but anyway, someone from Florida, maybe you can give us your first name. You got the mic. Go right ahead. Call from Florida.
Hi, John. I am Valdi from Florida.
How you doing?
Yeah, I am long-time listener. I am a first-time caller. I'm going to share the experience when I was in the first court with people, usually smallest court, which is the municipal court, municipal code enforcement court. I've been going to as the observer for last 6 months, and last time, that was a week ago, there was interesting conversation between the magistrate, who in his real life was the real estate attorney, and person who received some note from the city about overgrown tree branches. So the defendant said that he read something that, you know, he has a right. So the magistrate said, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the common law, and I am very familiar with that common law relating to the overgrown trees. I said, ooh, this is very interesting. He said, unfortunately, state and city has the right to override the common law. And I started laughing. But anyway, next thing we're going to say, that happened.
Well, that describes our problem, doesn't it, in a nutshell?
Yes, yes, exactly. But let me point it out something else. Since I heard that, I came home and I pulled the original ordinance which established the magistrate. So there was the established 3 years ago. That means that wasn't any magistrate before, but they kind of reorganized. So the ordinance have 7 pages, and I was present 3 years ago when this ordinance was passed. And what was most important, the commissioners read the ordinance by name only, not what's in it. And they voted, of course, for. And when I read that 7 pages, and I started asking myself, those commissioners read all the ordinance? And let me read you something, what is in it. The person who is, they use the language, the one who received the, how you call it, the one who violated the code, he is called a grieved or adversely affected person. So let me read you and you're going to get an idea. This is a very good one. Any aggrieved or adversely affected person desiring to become a party in the quasi-judicial proceedings shall provide a written notice to the clerk. At this notice, aggrieved or affected person should put his name, address, and telephone number, indicate how the aggrieved or affected person qualifies as an aggrieved or affected person, and listen, John, indicate whether the aggrieved or affected person is in favor or opposed to requested quasi-judicial action. In other words, they give you option to participate it or not. But the magistrate never read this to the, before he opened his court, so call it. He never advised the people who comes there and participated in it.
Well, that's very interesting, because the lawmakers agree with opposition and that the common law upholds.
Exactly.
And that is, these are nisi prius courts. They don't have the power
exactly.
or the authority to do anything without your permission. That's why they call it nisi prius, which means unless
exactly.
first. You first must first agree before they can do anything. So what we're going to do is go to force all
these courts. Let me finish.
Okay.
John, let me finish. Let you or ask the Brent what a quasi-judicial means. In my understanding, judicial is in the court. Quasi means in the parking lot or in the basement. I yield.
Okay, that's a good question. Brent, you want to respond to that one? Quasi? Do you have any comment on that?
Had to unmute. I hear him talking, nobody listening. But I still don't know if anybody's listening as far as that goes, I guess.
yeah,
good, okay. Well, quasi, as a practical matter, means that it's something that the powers that be don't want to declare it. They want it both ways. They want it to be criminal when they want it to be criminal. They want it to be non-criminal when they want it to be non-criminal. They want it to be judicial when they want it to be judicial.
Yeah.
They want it to be non-judicial.
Boy,
are
they good
yeah.
on that? It'll make
yeah.
us all neurotic, you know?
So that's right. And it goes flat dead against our idea of separation of powers. How can we as a people function if we don't know, for example, I tell my children, let me put it this way, I tell, they're grown now, but I still say it to a lot of people. I said the key to successful living, I believe this to be true, the key to successful living is to be able to discern in any given situation who has the right, who has jurisdiction. It may be you, it may be yourself, it depends on where you are, maybe you're in your own home. You have jurisdiction in your own home, that's your castle. You're in a courtroom. The judge has a certain jurisdiction within. It's a limited jurisdiction, but he has a lot of jurisdiction in the courtroom to do a lot of things. A police officer has a sheriff's deputy, has a lot of jurisdiction. We all have, a legislator has a certain jurisdiction, but we have the three jurisdictions, the three powers of government. There are only three, fundamentally. The legislative power, that's the power to make law, the judicial power, that's the power to interpret and tell how law is supposed to be applied. That doesn't, no, not apply it, just say what your opinion is about how it should be applied in an individual instance. So the job of jurors and courts. So you got legislative, you got judicial, and then you got executive. That's the fellow that enforces the laws. That's the power, for example, of the U.S. Marshal. That's the power of the president and all that million plus people that are employed in the executive department. And we have what we call in America a separation of powers, and that's true also of state governments. The state governments are common law governments. They have common law forms, and they separate the powers. And the three powers of government, the president at the national level, the governors at the state level, separate powers. There's not a country on the faces of the earth that do what we do in America that way. Even in the common law country of England, they confuse the separation of powers more than us. For example, to try to make this point clear and then say, well, this is who we are. In England, the chief executive officer of the country, as a matter of practicality, is also the leader of the dominant party and the head man in the legislative branch. He's called the prime minister. He's the head man in the legislative branch, and yet, still, the chief executive of the country. Why is that? Well, that's because when they had their war to try to sort this matter out a little more, actually, they was sorted out in old Anglo-Dane England before the Norman invasion of 1066. The Norman invasion of 1066 brought the imprint of Rome to some degree and kind of muddied the waters of separation of powers. And then Magna Carta was intent to return to pre-1066 England, when the separation of powers were clean and clear, and our Constitution of the United States was the same thing, because the English had their Civil War, and they fought about who was in charge. Was it Parliament, or was it the executive branch? Well, King Charles said, it's me. I'm the executive branch. I'm the king. They said, no, so they went to war. Parliament won the war. A lot of people were killed, thousands. Parliament won, and Parliament said, okay, now we're in charge. That's common law government. And they got into this Republican idea. What's republicanism? That means the legislature is in power. Well, we're not a country of republicanism. We're a country where have a republican form of government. That means we have a popularly elected legislature. As John Fortescue said in the 14th century, he said, there is a popular element to common law government, but it's a limited element. That's why we have a parliament. That's why we have a Congress. That's why we have a state legislature. But the Congress and the state legislature are not in charge of our states or our country. In England, Parliament is in charge. No one in England, and they say this, their law says this, no one calls the hand of Parliament. No one in the world can tell Parliament among men what to do. That's true. That's the way they look at it. That's tyranny, though, to a degree. We don't have that. We came to America and said, we don't want that. We'll continue the process over here. We're trying to get back to common law government. You fellas had your civil war, and you didn't do it. Instead of making separation of powers and co-equal branches of government, as it was in Anglo-Dane England, you fellas, you say now Parliament's in charge. And they found out that Parliament was pretty ugly and bloody. Once they had the power, they were going to abuse it. Well, we got to America. We had a war. As Winston Churchill said, our war with England in America, our war with England for separation was a continuation of the Civil War of England with a hiatus in the middle. That's all it was, really. And the sons and grandsons, George Washington was a grandson of a man who supported King Charles in England. That spells the difference between Virginia and New England. The people that settled in New England were members of the political party called Puritans who took over Parliament and defeated the king. Well, those two people got together. George Washington is famous. They won in Virginia. He represented those people who had descended from the Blue Bloods in England. And then, of course, the people in New England were the Puritans. They were the ones that had actually, the grandsons of the ones that had won the war. And they joined together from the North and from the South, and they saw the problem together, and they said, neither one of these are right. Let's make it right. Well, what's right? Separation of powers. And no quasi-legislative. We have now what we call quasi-courts, quasi-judicial branch courts. For example, the tax court, the IRS court. There is no such thing under our Constitution. Either you're in one or the other. And the three branches of government, all three of them, neither one of them, neither of the three trump the other two. Nobody's final. Nobody. In America, we live with this perpetual tension, this perpetual Mexican standoff. And we believe, as John Madison put it, that if as long as government is fighting and has a standoff going, then they'll leave us alone and we can be free to be productive. That's the idea. That's the whole idea of common law government. That's the government that those bloodthirsty tribes from the north of Europe brought to England, and we still have it. We still use the same phrases. We still have the fundamental same beliefs. The only difference is we've learned not to be so bloodthirsty because there was a wedding with what we today call the Bible, the Christian scriptures, with government. You say, well, we don't want religion and government. Well, I got news for you. Government is religion. It's religion externalized. That's what it is. And I understand the First Amendment. I understand the importance of government not interfering in churches. I understand that. But it's foolhardy, and our founders never said this. They never said that government is not religion externalized, and it is without debate that government is the business of God. And it is that influence, one individual at a time in a country like ours that makes government what it is. Fratcher used to say, prosecutor from Nuremberg, used to say that show me the governments of the dominant religious institutions of a country, and I'll show you the government of that country. Show me the forms of government of the dominant religious institutions of a country, and I'll show you the government of that country. Look at South America. Dictatorships. Look at America. Just as an example. We have rule by juries and elders. Those things come out of the Bible. Those things have been part of the Protestant Reformation and part of what happened in America early on. I can't say that's true now. I traveled through New England not long ago, through the mountains in New Hampshire and Vermont. Every little town I came to had a meeting house, and they all looked the same, all built the same, all the same old meeting house, 150 years old. Those were the old puritanical congregational churches in every little community. Well, people don't use those buildings for churches anymore. They use them for democratic meetings, as they say, community centers, things like that. We have lost our connection to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. And if that connection is not made by a critical mass of Americans, what we're hoping to do and what we want to do and the things we want to see good happen in our own country won't happen. It's impossible. There's never been anything like America in the history of mankind. And there's a reason for it. It was because men were driven to say that we want separation of powers. Men are not to be trusted to govern. Only God is to be trusted to deliver the rules of government, and we are to implement them. And how do we do that? We limit each other by separation of powers. This whole thing about quasi this and quasi that cannot be a part of a free country. It won't work. It's an effort of the evil empire to blur the distinctions. Watch. The word quasi is a blurring of distinctions, isn't it? We can't tell if it's this or that. What kind of distinctions is the evil empire trying to blur as I speak? Well, let's get real fundamental. They're trying to blur the distinctions as though there's no difference between men and women. Oh, there's a great difference, and thank God there is. I'd hate it if all women looked like men and acted like men. That would be a very unpleasant world for me. I hope it would be for you, too. But that's getting right down to the fundamentals, isn't it? But it's all about, the evil empire is all about, watch this word, uniformity. Uniformity. Where does uniformity come from? It's a martial word, a word of the law of the city. It's all about everything being the same. It's all about uniforms, everybody dressing the same, everybody stepping the same, everybody doing the same. A broad brush of a legislative power. Everybody does what he's commanded, what government commands him to do. We all do it the same. No exceptions. If we did what you wanted, Brent, if we did what you wanted, John or Gerard, if we did what you fellows wanted, well, we can't have everybody do that. Well, no, our common law says we can, and we must if we're going to be free. Uniformity is the goal of the blurring of distinctions, of making white kind of white and black kind of black. I remember reading, I'll bring this up one more thing, because I mentioned him a while ago, the flower of Oxford scholarship, John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe went through the plagues, the bubonic plague of England, where a third of the population wiped out. I forget, it was some unfathomable amount of people died. And everybody figured they'd be one of them. You know, we used to sing when I was in grade school, ring around the posy, rosy, rosy, pocket full of posy, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. That crime came from that time in England, Wycliffe. He lived through it. He made it. His friends and his family, a lot of them did. But with all of that hardship, it was said of him. Other people observed it. For John Wycliffe, black became blacker and white became whiter. The blurring, the intentional blurring of distinctions of his day, of the powers that be, began to go away. He began to see the world in clear terms. And the clearer you can see the world, the more you can see the distinctions that God has woven into the warp and woof of his creation, the more beautiful and wonderful and exciting life becomes. It just makes me, I don't want to sound like I'm overcome with emotion, but it makes me pretty happy to think that God has given us these beautiful colors of distinctions, the multivariegatedness, as the apostle puts it in the epistle, in Peter's epistle. Well, that's enough. Quasi is not part of our common law tradition, but I notice it pops up more and more and more. It is a lie. It is a lie. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Brent. Yeah, let me respond to the call a little bit also, or basically about what the caller called about and the problems. You know, one of the things we need to do once we, the people, take back control of the judiciary by taking back control of the juries, the grand jury, the trial jury, petit jury, whatever you want to call it, and, you know, we get to orientate them and bring them, you know, together as a jury to make the decisions that they need to make. And we've got to make sure that they're not tainted, not only not tainted by the prosecutor or the judge, but also not tainted by us. And that's an important point, and we're going to make a lot ado to concerning that, because we have a tendency to give our own opinions and thoughts and ideas, and we can never do that to the jury. We can give them the facts. We can train them as best we can about the common law and about the truth of things. And then it's up to them to make the decision. And we have to be very, very careful, because someone has to assist the grand jury in the writing of the indictment. So, and that would be the job of the administrators. And we're going to have to be somewhat knowledgeable of how to write these things and what exactly is to put down. But the key thing is to make sure that we represent the jury and express their decision, not ours. We've got to be very careful, otherwise we become guilty of the very same thing that we're trying to get rid of. But with that said, look, at one of the first things we will do and need to do is to make notice to every sheriff in America once we start to bring the courts back to courts of justice. And we need to make them understand that when they go to these town courts and these village courts and these municipal courts and any other one of these, courts that are basically are administrative courts, they're voluntary courts, they're what's called nisi prius courts, that anybody that is sent to his prison, to the county jail, who he's in control of, he's in charge of, anybody that's sent to the county jail from any of those courts, or anybody, let's put it even simpler than that, anybody that is sent into that county jail for any kind of a term of time that has not been indicted by a grand jury and found guilty by a petit jury in a court of law, okay? And town courts are not courts of law. Village courts are not courts of law. You know, I went down to the town court recently with a friend of mine. It was a couple of months ago. And the last time I'd been down is maybe about a year ago. And there's a big sign, Justice Court, you know. And I thought it was a big joke, Justice Court. You don't get no justice here. But the last time I went down there, they had removed the word justice. something must have come up there or something. They don't have the word justice up there no more, just the word court. And I think it's, you know, Hyde Park Court. I forget what they put there, but, well, I think they always had that. But they had Hyde Park Justice Court. The word justice is gone. And I found it very interesting. But in any event, the sheriff cannot hold a prisoner that has not been, first of all, indicted. I mean, they can hold a prisoner for a period of time. It's reasonable, depending until you get the indictment. But generally speaking, you should always find the indictment first, then go after the person. But if you catch someone robbing a store or shooting somebody or something like that, obviously you need to bring them down to the jail to be held. They need to, you know, go before a judge, who's going to make the decision to hold that person for a period of time until you get the indictment. An indictment should be pretty quick in coming, in any event. But the point is no jail should receive a prisoner that has not been indicted and tried and found guilty in a court of justice. And that's going to pretty much empty out the jails. They need to release any people that fits into that category. And that's probably going to release, I'll bet you, every bit of 80% of the people in jail right now in the county jails, at every bit of that. Probably bigger than that. Judge Bork, he made the statement, and I don't remember whether he said 80 or 90%, but he said 80 or 90%, whichever percentage it was, of the people that are in jail right now and today are there because they opened their mouth. You see, they went along with it. They accepted. They made the argument, and therefore they consented. In courts, they do not have the power or the authority to imprison, to incarcerate, that is, or to fine. They don't even have the power or the authority to fine you. So that's the facts. And so we have to make sure these people are released. And if they want to bring them into a court of justice, which they never will because all these charges are just code violations, and there's no, you know, no crime at all. But I'd like to say one thing. I know Brent was talking about republic and what a republic is. You know, it is true. The Constitution says we have a republican form of government, so we're supposed to be a republic. And I'll tell you what, it's very confusing when you go to these dictionaries and try to figure out what exactly is the word. It seems as if it's always going back to try to describe the republic as a democracy. You know, there are two different words. And again, you know, one of the key things I found, one of them is in Blacks and the other one is in Brovier's. In Blacks' dictionary, it says a commonwealth, that form of government in which the administration of affairs is open to all the citizen. In another sense, it signifies the state independently of its form of government. Now, it goes down, Republican government, okay, is a government of the people. Okay, now there's more information about this, but that's the key part of this whole thing. It's a government of the people. Now, if you go over into Beauvier's, it says the very same thing on a republican government. A government in the republican form is a government of the people. And it goes on to say it is usually put in opposition to a monarchy or an aristocratic government. But it's a government of the people. I know we make a big deal about the Constitution for the United States of America in opposed to of the United States of America. And the proper words, of course, would be for the United States of America. It doesn't come from the United States of America. It comes from the people. And it's for the United States of America. It's the law that is applied by them. And in this form of republic that we have is, of course, a constitutional republic. I'm not sure whether that word goes along, connected constantly with it, a republican form of government automatically has a constitution, but I don't know how it could not be. Because if it's a government of the people, the only way that they can control that government and write laws to control that government is by a constitution. And we indeed do have the most unique constitution the world has ever seen, a constitution that is so small on one hand and so controlling of what the powers are on the other hand and restricted And it seems that, and especially the Bill of Rights is really the capstone of our Constitution is the Bill of Rights, because at the end of the day, the final yardstick to discover whether something is null and void is the Bill of Rights. And these guys really have hammered out the most important parts of the government. I mean, they have covered so much in so little words, and they covered so much. And I think, I don't know that a better job could be done. Now, there are a couple of problems with it, but it doesn't necessarily affect us, at least in our day and age anymore, the slavery problem, the two-thirds person. And of course, that was something that... you know, some of the states just didn't want to go along with it. It was repugnant, and nevertheless, they collapsed to that. They shouldn't have collapsed to that. They should have held off, and I think the colony still would have came together as a union and become states and become the United States of America. But anyway, that's just one of them. But again, these are things that don't affect us too much today. But a government of the people, we the people, ordained and established this Constitution for the United States. Now, that being said, they are chained down, as Jefferson said, you know, by the chains of the Constitution. Okay? And now in our Republican form of government, in our government of the people, and our Constitution, we have restricted Congress to legislate only certain things. And of course, they have gone beyond that. They've abused their power and authority. They are so ignorant, they don't even know when they're doing wrong anymore, it seems. It is really that serious. You know, it's bad enough that we don't know, but it's even worse when they don't know. They have no clue. They could have stopped. If we had an educated representatives in Congress, some of them, their conscience would bother them if they understood how much evil that they're really part of. I mean, there are certain times I'm sure they absolutely know. They can discern what is evil and what is not. But I don't think they can discern much of anything anymore. Their ignorance is so far. I mean, to call us a democracy, we clearly are not a democracy. We are a government of the people. And we have government, as the Declaration of Independence says, government by consent. Consent of the people. And so we consent to our government. We consent to what they can do and what they can't do through the Constitution. And we further put further restrictions upon them with a Bill of Rights. And any violation of that Bill of Rights, and that Bill of Rights extends on to much, much more freedoms and liberties than what it says, and it becomes logical and obvious. Okay, you know, the marijuana idea that Brent brought up, the alcohol idea that Brent brought up. Look, if my neighbor wants to put a needle in his arm and kill himself, that's his freedom and prerogative to do. Of course, I would try to talk him out of it, I would try to talk them out of it and maybe, you know, explain things to maybe change their mind. But ultimately, it is their decision, okay? It has nothing to do with me to decide for that person, nor does it have anything to do with the government to decide. And our Constitution is crystal, crystal clear. This, if we can just, you know, they're talking about a constitutional convention. Why not trying to use this, what we have first, before we think we need a constitutional convention? For what? We do not need it. There is absolutely zero reasons. I can't find one reason to have a constitutional convention. None. Not here in New York. They're trying to get one going here. I hear about them talking about a CONCON on a federal level. I mean, it's absurd, you know. And people, they're so ignorant to it because they got their eyes closed. We need to wake them up. You know, I speak to myself first. I was ignorant to it. My eyes have been opened. I can see. And we need to wake up more people. But seeing isn't enough. Seeing and doing is what's required. Seeing and not doing is a sin. Seeing requires action now. You have a duty. It doesn't matter. You have a duty. He's a human being, and you can see you have a duty to do something to fix the wrongdoing, because that's the purpose of life, is to do no harm. And if you have it within your power to stop others from being harmed, you have a duty to do that. And having the knowledge to know how to stop this out-of-control government, we have a duty to do something about it. If there is a possibility, we need to try it and do it. And, of course, that's what National Liberty Alliance was built upon and around. We have government by consent. As Brent brought up earlier, we consent, yay or nay. They come for a conviction. They want to come for an indictment, let's say. We listen and we say, okay, yeah or no, take a hike. That simple, nothing else to talk about. That's control of our government. They're deciding on what they want to do to any of the people. And, of course, if we decide, well, okay, it looks like there's enough for an indictment, we send them into a trial jury, and the jury makes the final decision. Judge has no power or authority to say what the law is. That's up to the people. It comes from the heart to begin with. And it's all in the facts and the injury. It's all there. You don't need no special words laid out to tell us what to do and what not to do and how much time, if time is necessary. I mean, prison is the last thing we want to do to anyone. We want to restore the individual. Therein is the punishment. So we have government by consent, by consenting to the judicial process, yay or nay, period, end of subject. We have government by consent in the political process as committeemen, the power and the authority to choose our own leaders. Of course, that has been hijacked, okay? But look it, we need to bring it back. We can recapture it. And I don't want to get into too much of it, but I brought it up before, and I'll say it again. I have not found an elected committeeman anywhere in the United States of America, other than a few people here in New York who I knew ran and did it properly, and were elected. Now, their time of office has been over. I don't know how many people are still running under those conditions, so we may have a few left in New York. We've been focusing our attention here. But look, it's pretty sad when you have unelected people deciding on who's going to go on to the ticket. That's the people's job in the election district, to have an individual to represent them, the will of those people, and to come in and to decide whether they're going to support an individual to get onto the ballot or not. It's that simple. And one of the requirements to get onto the ballot is, what do you know about the Constitution? What are you going to tell me about the Bill of Rights? What's going on in the courts today? What are you going to do to stop the injustice? You know, these are the kind of questions these people need to be asked, and they're not going to be able to answer them. You're going to have to send them home and tell them, go learn this stuff. Here, you can go here to learn this stuff, but go learn this stuff and come back. Until you learn it, you can't get in. You see, that's what we the people need to do. We need to have the knowledge and the understanding that this is what's necessary to do, to have people that is going to be obedient to the Constitution, to obey the law of the land. That's a Republican form of government, a government of the people. And that is the key, okay, of the people. There are a lot of bad Republican countries out there. You know, you got the Republic of China. Russia's a republic. There's quite a few republics out there. And so they're claiming to be government of the people, but they're not. But I have a sad tale or truth to tell you. We think we're a government of the people, and we're not. We're not because we the people are too ignorant to know what that means, and we're too ignorant to do anything about it. And I'm sad to say, and I'm frightened to say, most of the people may never come around. I mean, they're down to tweeting. Forget about reading a book. They're down to tweeting. I'm out of step because I don't have a smartphone. I want no part of the smartphone. I mean, it's good for someone in business, keeps a track of things and all other stuff. But other than that, to use it as a toy, it's only destructive is what it is. You can't get a real thought out that's worth anything out of tweeting. You can get an opinion out and a feeling out, but you can't really get much. I mean, you can probably get a few things, but you can't get much out that's really worth chewing on, generally speaking. Anyway, at least people aren't doing that. But anyway, a Republican form of government, from the way we understand it, is a government of the people, and we truly can be a government form of a government of the people if we get up and do what it has to do. We take control of our courts. We take control of our political process and the committeeman process, and we start to decide who's going on that ballot, and we exercise the right that we the people have, the right of recall. you put someone in office and they swore to obey the Constitution and uphold it and to do this and to do that, and they take money from special interest group. Well, first of all, we need to indict that person, because that's a crime to begin with. And the committee men, they need to recall that person, because they violated everything. They went there to represent the people. And what they need to know and understand is they need to represent the people in such a fashion, especially these people are running for Congress, okay? Let me read what they need to be doing. Right here in the beginning of the Constitution, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. So we have this to form a more perfect union amongst the states. The law is the same from one end to the other. Whatever is lawful in one state is lawful in the other state. It goes right across. So a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty, period. If they're not doing one of those things in whatever they're doing in Congress, then they shouldn't be doing it at all. It needs to be supporting those points and those six purposes or reasons for government. And right after that, it says, we do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. This Constitution is of we the people. We created this Constitution for them. And that's what makes us different. It's not the Republican form of government that is the key, but it is the Republican form of government that truly focuses in, without the lie, a government of the people that truly is a government of the people. And that's the key. And now, a lot of other republics, again, you know, they have for the working man or something in Russia and China and all that stuff, and they call themselves a republic. They're for the people. It's a government of the people. But really, it's a government for the people, because the government is dictating to them what they're going to do for them. Where in the other way around, government of the people, we are dictating to the government what they can do and can't do. This is our government, and we're going to consent to the courts, and we're even going to consent to your legislation. If it's outside, you got to stay within the criteria, and we will nullify anything that is repugnant to this Constitution. I've heard some talk recently, a couple of people here or there, not necessarily directed to a conversation to me, but I've heard conversations where people are talking and or making an opinion or a thought or an idea that the federal government shouldn't have any control over the constitution of the state government. And nothing could be further from the truth. When eight states signed into the union, they agreed to the Constitution for the United States of America as being the law of the land. That is first and foremost. And any state, any legislator of any state that makes any law to the contrary, any state court that makes any decision to the contrary is null and void. It's not part of the law of the land. It is in opposition to the law of the land. And I'm looking for that where does it say this? Trial, treason. Oh, I think it's in 5 or 6. Oh, yeah, here it is. It's in 6, Article 6. This Constitution and law of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made of which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. And that's the contract to the state. And that is a great thing. We have a great Constitution, and this really does protect our unalienable rights. And if they're obedient to this book, this tiny little book, I mean, it's so thin and so small. I mean, that's real law right here. That's got a whole bunch of law in it. And yet it's so small. But if they're obedient to this book, okay, that is protectable of us. And I don't want any state to have any authority in any constitution or any legislator of any state to the contrary. That's why we're going up against the gun laws in New York. They have no power or authority to do or say what they're doing, to put us in jail because we don't follow their prescription of having a weapon or what a weapon is and what we can carry and what we can't carry. We don't have that. So, okay, anyway, I guess we'll move on to the next person. So we'll take the next caller, if I can find my board here. Okay. Let's go to Eric, it looks like, maybe. Yes, Eric. What state you're from, Eric?
I'm from Georgia.
Hey, Eric from Georgia.
Hey, how are you? Let's see here. Listening to a fellow alternative news source, and he brought up something that I've been thinking about for some years now. Oh, yeah, real quick. There's a fellow named Vince Edwards in Colorado. He's being railroaded, and what they're trying to do to him, the things that judges make up, is they're trying to tell the, from what I've heard him say, is they're going to tell the jury that they have to decide whether or not he's guilty or innocent, but they're not going to tell him what it, they're not going to tell, the judge isn't going to tell the jury what it means when they say that he's guilty. In other words, they're going to hide how long they're going to imprison him for, how many years. Just some, you know, law of the city madness. More priestcraft.
Well, Kremlin, you know, I was blown away when I heard Brent say that, what is it, that four of our states, if I heard him right, I think he said 46 states, still use the grand jury. Brent, if you're here, correct me on this, because I'd like to know what states they are. I guess there are four states that don't use the grand jury. I'm blown away by that. Yeah, I did not have that realization. Brent, if you know the names of those states, I'd love to know myself. I'll stay out of those states.
That was my thought, too. That was exactly my thought. Stay out of those states.
Well, you know, what a violation, you know, what an argument you could make in those states, and what a violation of our unalienable rights. I mean, just think about it. It's right in the Bill of Rights that we must be indicted. An indictment must be had in order to have a court case against us. And we have that right of the jury, you know, but we have to, they first have to indict us, and it has to be done by a grand jury. I mean, goodness. I don't know how they get away with it, you know. And the other thing, you know, this idea of Justinian law, I had read this in Brent's book, and I learned that from Brent's book, that it was just really heightened Babylonian law and really was just put in a different package and a different name, and they use it. And they use that here, you know, common law, and they refer to Justinian, the justice of Justinian. I mean, I'm appalled by that idea. And, you know, under the Justinian process, you know, you have chancellors. You go out to Pennsylvania, you have chancellors and you have chanceries. I mean, my goodness, they still doing that here? Yeah, they're doing it right in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure in a lot of other states. And people don't understand or realize it has no part to do with the law of the land. You know, the law of equity permits, you know, a tribunal of judges, okay, and not the people necessarily, but people who are, you know, judges, and we call them judges. We permit one judge to make a decision, and then we have an appellate system, an appeal process you can go through, where they have a few judges to, you know, if you want to challenge that, and so that is that's your equity court system there. You can't have a crime tried in those courts. And if you don't want that to be tried in the court on a contract thing or whatever you're in the court for, as long as it's over $20, you can get a jury court, trial by jury. You always want to take a trial by jury these days. You know, you can't get the right decision on these judges. They're going to fight tooth and nail to keep you away from the jury, though. That's a fact. We see it all the time. See it all the time. And they try to take control of the court, you know. But go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, let me tell you, this fellow, just real quick, and then let me get to my question. It's pretty simple, I think. It's a simple question. The answer might be complex. But this fellow, I think he's in, don't quote me on this, Castillo County in Colorado. He's trying to live off the grid, and this fellow whose land I think he's been on, I'm not sure for sure if this is exactly right. Don't quote me on this, but you go to YouTube, Steve Motley, and look for a recent video from retired Marine Steve Motley, and you can find more information beneath the video, and you can find more information there if you're interested. But this fellow, Charlie's being railroaded end of this month, and then he's going to be railroaded 1st of April, if anyone in Colorado is interested. All right, interested in being a courtroom observer, or helping out in any way they can. Okay, now here's the question. The second question is, federal prisons, does that count as federal land? I sure do hope not. But the real question I'm after tonight is, this alternative news source that I listened to, he said, I think it was 1931, and I guess it was FDR. What a commie there. But he said that that's when they started treating everyone outside of the 10 square miles of D.C., as an enemy. I think they would call it the Trading with the Enemy Act. And up until then, you didn't have to have a business license to do business in your own state here in America. And I want to get your opinion on business licenses, because I didn't really know that, but they've always, ever since I've been learning about the common law, the idea of a business license really rubs me the wrong way. I appreciate being regulated.
Well, absolutely. You cannot license a person's, right to work, their trade. You can't license them. I mean, there are certain things that are you can license, and, and we'd have to think about what that might be. But nevertheless, I want to go back to this prison thing. I can't find any place in the Constitution where Congress has been given the authority to create a prison. I mean, where is that? Okay. You know, if you try a person in a particular state, let's say it's a federal, let's say the federal government has jurisdiction over a particular crime a case, and the person gets tried in the federal court. And let's say it's in New York, and let's say it's at the Northern District of New York, so let's say it's in Albany, or one of the other counties up there, Rensselaer or whatever, that's in the Northern District, let's say it's Rensselaer. Well, they have to be tried in that county where the crime was committed, okay, to begin with, in that federal district. But then why do they have to ship them six states away or whatever it is that they do? Okay, there's a jail right there. It's called the county jail. And if it's a necessity for someone to be imprisoned, which should be very minimum usage of using a prison, but if that is required, it's a violent thing or something, and there's a prison sentence, let's say, well, put them in jail right there. You know, why do they have to ship them far away? They need this, first of all, and then they say that, that they're trying to help these people in prison somehow, that they're going to repair them. What do they call them? They call them correctional facilities, and they call them, going to rehabilitate them, and they do nothing to rehabilitate anyone. They treat them like animals, so what do you expect when they get out? They're going to be an animal, okay? But they need to be close to their families to get support. And besides that, they've been taken away from their families. The families have a right to be able to see them and not have to travel six states where they can't get to. I know, in any event, that's what needs to be done. I mean, why do we have federal prisons? If we empty out the prisons of all the unlawful imprisonments alone, again, as I mentioned earlier, bare minimum, and I'm clearly sure of this, a bare minimum is 80% of the people would be released, okay? And if 80% of the people are released in the county jails, why would we ever need a federal prison, okay? I just don't understand that. And again, I don't see any authority in the Constitution for them to build and create prisons. I mean, I know they talk about useful buildings, but that clearly is not a useful building. There's no authority on it anywhere in Article 1. And there's no reference to it in Article 3, which is the judiciary. So,
well,
that really bothers me. but yeah, you
Brent talked about this
licensing,
tonight.
Licensing, huh?
Brent talked about this tonight. The pretended offenses. It sounds like that. That's what it sounds like. It sounds exactly like the grievance at our foundings. Now, go to the license again. What were you about to say about the license? I want to hear what you're going to say on that.
Yeah, look at licenses. I can understand how certain things could require a license, and it shouldn't be given by the state necessarily. Let's take someone who's going to do surgery on you. I mean, we've got to make sure that person's qualified. But you know what? There is no such thing as a license, at least not by the state, okay, for to be a lawyer. None whatsoever. There is no licensing of a lawyer. It doesn't exist, okay? Now, you know, you can have qualified and have a degree, and that's good enough to show an individual that you're qualified in that area. Or if the person, you know, I don't have a degree, and I think I could represent people if I had the ability to go, you know, if I had the situation to go to court. We're going to be representing people. We have, as a matter of fact. you know, there's no law requiring me to be a lawyer to represent a group of people, other people. And it's not even clear, you know, basically even if I'm not part of that situation, I should have the right to be able to represent people. As long as the people, you know, it's their decision to make sure that someone's qualified to be able to represent them. And I'll tell you what, most lawyers are not qualified to represent you. I just hear horror story after horror story after horror story. And with very few exceptions, you know, most lawyers are nothing but a bunch of liars. And judges are lawyers. They're a bunch of liars, too. And
Jurisdictionary says that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And he's a good guy, but he's lost in a few places. But he's a good guy. He's got his heart in the right place, you know. And,
yeah, he says,
of course,
he calls him
Hey,
yeah, that's true. That's true. We got Brent here. Of course, he's a different breed. But what if you were going to open up a restaurant or a food truck or a small retail outfit, say where you sold secondhand clothes? How important do you think it would be
That's a good question. I don't think I'm qualified to really answer that. I think it's something we need to give thought and talk about. There are certain things we do want to make sure that things are run properly. And I don't know that I'm qualified really to comment too much on or make a conclusion. And it would be, you know, I don't think I have enough information. But I got to agree that there are certain situations that should be licensed. I got to think on that end. And I may be proven wrong on that, so I'll leave that open to that. I don't have a conclusion on it. But generally speaking, if there's anything you could throw at me, I can tell you don't need a license for. You know?
Yeah. Well, let me tell you how it's going with restaurants. Look at here. With a restaurant, the health inspector, it's as if they have to justify their own existence by creating more and more restraint. And every year there's a new restraint. You got to do something more every single year. Now, I've been in the restaurant business for a long time. I appreciate there's a basic things you got to do to run a clean place. And most people who run a restaurant, they want to do these things. But if things continue the way they're going, I'm going to have to wear something akin to a hazmat suit in a couple of years just to work my job. Now, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but that's the way it's headed. You see what I'm saying?
No, I understand that, and I can see why you're saying that. And, you know, look, again, you're in an area that you do need some kind of control, obviously, just like, you know, you would need control out of anything that you would call medicine. You want to make sure that it's got good quality control on it and so on and so forth. But they always do go out of the way. But here's the problem here. Here's the problem, in my opinion, anyway. And I can't really speak too much on the restaurant thing, but in most cases, it's corruption, okay? And now, it may not be in your case. I mean, I could tell you from the contracting business, it's corruption, okay? And if you can bring law and order into the courts, if you can bring them back to courts of justice, okay, put the king back into the court, and if you could control these people that are being elected to be able to enforce them, to require them to be obedient to their oath, okay, which, again, these are the things we're working to. If you can get those two things done, corruption on all these other levels, I think, are going to disappear real quick. A lot of these things they get away with because they're taught by the people who are elected in the system or were appointed in the system that they're underneath, and they're doing the same thing. They're rubbing shoulders with them. They feel that they got carte blanche. They're going to get away with it. They get a certain amount of protection because once you pull one string, it does a whole bunch of other things also. But after a while, in any event, look, that's my buddy. I'm going to watch over and make sure, you know, this, that, or the other thing. There's payola going back and forth, and it's just endless. Corruption breeds corruption breeds corruption. A nation will be as just and only as just as its courts, period. So our political process will be as corrupt as our courts. So same thing.
All right. Well, this falls under that. But since you brought up the doctor thing, I just want to make this point. Even though they're licensed and whatnot, and you'd want to have them licensed, their paradigm is outmoded, it's outdated, but also they are protected from the common law because of their malpractice agreements with every state and everything that they do. You can't sue these people anymore. And I think it's the number three killer of all folk is these doctors making mistakes. And I'm pretty sure because they're protected in this malpractice deal that they make more mistakes. If they actually knew that their neck was on the line, they'd make less mistakes. You see what I'm getting at? But I'm sure what you just said covers that too.
Most people die because they go to a doctor, okay? The doctors are great for a couple of things. Doctors are really great if you get mangled up in a car crash or something like that, or if you do have to get a bypass and you have a heart attack and they can maybe give you another heart or repair a valve or something of that nature. I mean, they're really great for that kind of stuff. But anything other than that, you know, I go to the doctor only for the prognosis. I want to find out, the diagnosis. I'm sorry, not the prognosis, the diagnosis. I just want to find out what it is I got and what's going on. And then I start researching to see what I could do about it. And it's been my point. This is a very strong opinion of mine at this point. And again, it could change, but it's a strong opinion. I put this point in my life that any kind of a problem you have could really be dealt with vitamins and supplements. Because one thing leads to another thing and it almost always, even heart disease, always goes back to a deficiency somewhere and certain things that you're deficient of. And, of course, there are certain supplements which will assist the body in this or in that and then allow it to produce the necessary vitamins or to be able to use a vitamin. You know, I was reading about something, I think it was vitamin K or something, is really an important vitamin. I'm not sure whether it was one or two, but it was a very important vitamin in order for vitamin D to have an effect. And vitamin D is an extremely important vitamin because it is really, it works on really fighting against the flu or against colds or any of those things. Vitamin C, you know, again. So really, you're going to these doctors, you know, and, you know, I have a particular problem and they tried a few things and I really don't like any of those things and I wasn't going to use them. It didn't work, so. And then they said, well, look, at you know, we're finding out that this particular pill might work on you, and it's just a drug to me. And again, I said, well, what's that for? What is it normally used for? And they said, well, it's used for depression. And I said, well, why would I want to take a pill used for depression? What's that going to do to me? You know, is that going to depress me? Is that going to cause other kind of problems? And by the way, here in New York, they're going to come and get my guns, you know? When you get something like that, they claim that you have a problem and they got to take your guns away. I mean, it's getting to that point here in New York. But anyway, yeah, doctors, they're only good to get a diagnosis. I don't listen to a darn thing they say. But I listen to what the diagnosis is, you know, whatever you get reading out of the blood, and whatever that tells us, and, you know, so on and so forth. But then I work over to vitamins. So they're a problem. Go to a doctor, you're going to die. Yeah. You get cancer, guaranteed to die in most likelihood. And if you get cured, you'll probably be cured for a couple of years and you'll die a couple of years later anyway from cancer. Because they still haven't dealt with the problem. It's a vitamin deficiency.
Yeah.
Mostly
yeah.
Vitamin C.
And you brought up another thing. I just want to bring this up now. These serotonin reuptake inhibitors, there's a website called SSRI Stories. You want to see a common denominator in all of these places, these schools being shot up, Go look up SSRI stories, and you'll see what are the common denominators. It's these drugs. They cause these states, these psychotic states, and they incline people towards this behavior. I believe that 100%. Montreal Healthy Girl. Check this girl out. She talks about not just supplements and vitamins, but your diet in general. And she says she's known people who have cured these things that doctors call incurable, such as sexually transmitted diseases and cancer and such. And then there was a fella up in your neck of the woods by the name of Vail, who sits in federal prison right now because he was crushing up nectarine pits and curing people of their cancer with the seeds inside.
B-17?
But anyway, I'm sorry?
Is that B-17 in there?
I believe so. Liotril? He was doing that.
Liotril? Yeah.
Liotril. There you go.
Liotril is vitamin B-17. Can you believe they have, here in New York, and I don't know if it's everywhere, I guess it's a federal thing, they made it illegal for a vitamin. I mean, what the heck is that? I mean, come on.
You ran a business. Can you? And this is what they're doing. Can you imagine your employees telling you that you can't do things that you know are good for you, the health of your business? That's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a problem. Well, I was union for a very short while, and that's almost what happened. But I wasn't union for long. Let me tell you. But in any event, it ended very violently, to be honest, and not from me being violent to them. Trust me. But
wow.
All right, let me move on to another caller because we don't have much time left.
Yes.
Let me just take at least one more caller. We'll see how much time we're going to spend.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's take Tyler, VoIP caller, Tyler. Go right ahead, Tyler. You should have been unmuted. Let me try it again. Okay, you're unmuted, Tyler. Tyler? One more call for Tyler. Okay. Let's take our next caller, and we've got Fred, California Fred. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good, George. How are you guys?
Good, thanks.
Is Brent still on the line?
Brent, are you here? We got to keep it short, though. We only got 2 minutes left, and I'm going to close early. I'm going to close at 12 o'clock tonight, and we should always try to close at 12. But so we only got 2 minutes.
Well, it's the same question I had last week at timeout.
Oh, okay. Well, try getting in the call early next week.
Well, I didn't want to bump
right
them.
After Brent gets off, you know.
Well, right. I'll ask you so Brent can prepare for this question because it got butchered last time.
Okay.
Let me lead up to this.
Why don't we do it first thing next call next week? Get in the beginning of the queue because this way we could take someone else because we're not going to, you know, be able to go very far with the conversation and you're going to bring it up to Brent anyway. So let's bring it up next Monday. Okay, get in early to the queue.
All right. Said, bye. All right.
Okay, let's take another caller. We got Tyler again is unmuted. Last call for Tyler. Are you there? Tyler. Okay, let's go to Felicia in Florida. You got the mic. Only got a minute or two. Felicia in Florida. Okay. Felicia, are you there? Let me see if I can click that button, see if that helps. Felicia? Okay. Let's go to, next caller. Don't have a phone name.
Yes.
575 phone number?
Yes. Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yeah, give us your first name and state.
Hey, everyone. It's me, Jeremiah, from California.
Oh,
Northern California.
How you doing, Jeremiah?
Yep. Hey, what's up, everyone?
You had a bad connection. It doesn't sound like you, but go ahead.
It doesn't? Okay, well, I'm sorry about
that. Little,
is
a little
that,
gobbly.
Is that better?
But go ahead. I can understand you, though. Go ahead.
Okay, hold on. What I did was I just unplugged my headphones. Is that better?
Oh, a lot better, yep.
Okay, great. Well, basically, I think that the common law has been hijacked by rogue elements, rogue people that are simulating these processes, and jury process is the most powerful remedy right now. And I know that townships are actually a fixture inside of the inside America. I mean, we still have townships to this very day. Exist.
By the way, the judges disagree with you. They would tell you that the common law has been abrogated, but go ahead.
I never said common law, though. All I said was townships.
What did you say? Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about the common law.
Yeah, but I was heading in that direction, so you're a wise man, sir. But what I was really heading towards was understanding that what we're dealing with here is a clash of titans, if you will, of fixtures in law, which consist basically of the common law, which is obviously what elements of evidence, as well as jury process and things of that nature, and community-based, grassroots, bottom-up technology when it comes to government. And then that versus civil law, civil authority, which is something that has a lot related to if you just look at the canon laws, religious canon laws of the Catholic Church, there's a lot of statutory things going on there, as well as the Islamic religion. Islam has a lot of statutes.
We're about to run out of time, Jeremiah, so if you could make it a little shorter, maybe next time you get on a little earlier, but go ahead.
All right. Thank you very much. Ultimately, everyone, just remember that the battle between the common law and the civil law is a very, very right here, right now type of battle, and you're involved in it. If you're hearing this message, then you're the one that can actually make the difference.
One of the things I hear from lawyers all the time is they think that the common law is case law, and I think some of these judges out there think, well, yeah, well, they operate as if it is. They permit those arguments, and they rest upon the case law, and that's total insanity. But they do. All right, let me move on. You know, I got one more person. I'm going to give them two or three minutes, and then we're going to close down. So, and again, if you want to expound on this again, bring it up next week. So, okay, one other person left in the queue. We're going to unmute you and see if you're there. 949, first name and state. You got the mic.
Hi. Yeah, hi. Thank you. Is this Jan?
This is John.
Hi, John. I'm Amy, and I'm with, I'm a veteran. I'm start of FSCHS, and then now it's PAX International, STARS International, Massachusetts Targeted Individuals. Anyway, Tyler was trying to get on. I've been trying to help him. He's a veteran, and he's in South Columbia, South Carolina. They put him in this against his will, medicating him against his will. He's a Navy veteran of 6 years. He's very clear-headed, very on top of things as I speak to him. Frank is one of the moderators from Massachusetts, and I just discovered him just a few days ago. So we're trying to see about habeas corpus because his military pay, of course, they're using it to basically pay for the VA, budget, as that goes. And one of the top of the VA people was just fired yesterday or today. So it's been a common thing. I'm a veteran. I go to the VA myself. They put him in the VA in the psych ward several times because he refused to take the Seroquel forced medication because he's not psychotic. He did.
Well, were you talking to Jim about this or Jan?
I was actually. I tried to get a hold of Jan, and he had my number. And then last year, all the numbers changed. Constance Robinson was the one that gave me your number, and I've been a targeted individual for probably the whole 19 years I was in the Air Force. But I was a first sergeant and all that. But.
Have you been talking to Jim or James about this particular case? Because I know I think
no,
Jim
I've
was talking
to
potential
reach someone,
habeas corpus.
But I do need phone numbers
to get him on. Let me suggest
And they're censoring the text to him. They're sending him in Chinese when I text to him now. And I said, that's no surprise. They're really afraid of me because I work with high-level Pentagon officials on various things, and I do not fear them. I'm a whistleblower, and I'll continue. Uh-huh. And I love everything that you guys are doing. So if you can get me contact information.
Okay, well, if you go to the directory, okay, and you can send Jan an email or give him a call, and he'll pass you the name and number, probably of Jim. And
the old number I have for Jan is disconnected. So
yeah, he changed some numbers, but if you go up to the directory, you'll see his new number up there.
I've been having trouble even getting to that. So do you have his email?
You could send him an email, Jan at nationallibertyalliance.org.
Okay.
I think Jim, don't you have an email, Jim at or James? I think we got Jim an email on that.
And then where do I send my membership? Because I do want to be a member, and I do love
if you go up to our donate. Go up to our donate page on the top right-hand side and click on that to give you various ways.
Okay.
If you want to get into the course, then, you know, we're looking for people who are going to give $5 a month or more, and then you'll be able to get that course that we're getting ready in the next week or two to get up there, which will be a very powerful course.
Good, because I know a lot about 9/11, and I was in part of that war campaign, too.
All right, send Jan. I'm trying to think of the email that we know goes to the I can't think of the email. It goes to the people who will help you be able to talk to you a little about it.
It's an intake.
Jim's on the call. Intake. Okay, send
intake.
Up to intake at nationallibertyalliance.org. Right, and that should get to Jim. And let Jim get most of the information, and then we'll see if we could do something. Okay?
Jim, what's his last name?
Well, I don't want to give any last names. Just Jim right now.
Okay.
That's good.
Jim,
but,
intake?
Intake. Just intake at nationallibertyalliance.org. And Jim gets the mail. There's a couple of people mailing that. But he's on right now. He's hearing the call. So he'll keep an eye open for it. And he'll send you to a place to fill out a form and get information and tell the story and make an affidavit, and then Jim will get in touch with me, and then we'll see what we can do. Bear in mind, we're super overloaded here. I mean, really, really super.
I understand. I do get that. And I know May is the end date where he'll lose all rights permanently. And I don't understand why he didn't have a
I don't know how that could be. I'm very interested in hearing the story here. Get it to Jim, I'm very interested. I don't know how they can lose a right forever. I mean,
I know
how they can force anyone, but I like to hear the story, okay?
This is common with the VA. This is really common.
Okay. Matter of fact, Jim's on the call right now. I'm going to unmute him as we're talking.
Wonderful.
Jim, go ahead. Are you unmuted, I think? Try talking.
Hi, Jim. Are you there?
Jim, do you see Jim is unmuted?
Just a second, Jack.
I'll give you my phone number.
Let's try that. Oh, I'm sorry. I lost the caller here. Let me see if I can bring the caller back.
Hi, John.
How you doing?
Okay.
Amy, are you back?
Okay. Can I give you my phone number?
Jim, you wanted to say something, Jim? Go ahead.
The best way to do it is to just do like John said, fill it out. Send me an email to intake at National Liberty Alliance, and then I reply back, and we go from there.
That's the best way.
Yeah, and the first thing you want to do is make sure that Jim gets the story and exactly what's going on. You write it up or something, but make sure he understands so he can articulate it to me, and because I'm interested in hearing about this story, okay?
Yeah, that was Tyler that was trying to get on the call, and they were blocking him when you were trying to unmute him, so... I don't know what happened there, and, you know, even with my texts, they're not going through to him. So, but thank you for all that you're doing. It's just you guys are awesome, and just I love everything you're doing, and I want to join in helping, putting my hands, getting in there, and helping you out, too, because we're all in this together.
Okay, appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, let's... the board here. Okay, thanks everybody for coming to tonight's call, and Lord willing, we will be back next Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and let's see where we go with this course. And again, anybody wants to register the course, now is the time to get out there and start registering. And the course should be available in the next week or two, should be started. Okay, with that, appreciate it. Good night. See you next Monday. Good night.